bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show on the road, the People's Tour for America. Tonight on the big program, we're going to talk about what went on in Salt Lake City, Utah, as the People's Tour rolled in to the salted area. And it was, what a beautiful city.
Oh my God, it's amazing. I mean, every single direction you turn in, there are craggy, gigantic, snow-capped mountains. Just beautiful.
Probably one of the most beautiful cities I've ever been in.
Well, the architecture and the city itself is lovely, but nothing beats like old mommy nature.
Yep.
Just put on a display of majesty that was amazing. I can see why Brigham Young got there and said, nah, this is where we're staying, peeps.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Just breathtaking. But I got to be honest, you know, and going back and looking at the entire trip, you know, coming out of San Jose, going up toward up to Portland, and then across just majestic country, just, you know, growing up in a city where, you know, every square inch seems to be developed. You know, you get out to these places where there's nothing but nature and beauty for hundreds of miles.
You definitely understand why we stole it from the Indians. You know, makes sense. Gotta have that. It is gorgeous. You know, I played hooky and left you and Brett and took off with Carol. And the two littlest children, Alex and Allie. And we went up to Crater Lake, which is in Oregon. It's the deepest lake on in the United States. And that means it's about 1,800 feet deep. Now, when you think about a lake being, they're usually a couple of hundred feet deep.
Not touching the bottom there, are you?
No. And it's a couple of, I think, 2,000 feet below the top of the volcano that it used to be. So the lake itself, the top of the lake itself is at 12,000 feet, and you can keep driving up past it.
Wow.
And nothing feeds it, so there's no silt. It was a whole blast there about 17,000 years ago. And it's been filling with rainwater and snow for those 17,000 years. And so it's got millions and millions of cubic gallons of water in it. And it is absolutely the prettiest color blue I have ever seen.
So let me get this straight. We haven't touched it. There's no inlets. There's no outlets. It's just this bowl of water?
Just a big bowl of water. And somehow it has fish in it. And all I can think of is birds catch fish. And sometimes they get away from them. And some bird flying over that Crater Lake dropped a couple of fish in it. I don't believe that humankind stocked it with fish. It's really amazing. Did you ever hear about the guy? It was about a year and a half ago. He's playing golf. He's on, like, the fourth hole. And all of a sudden, a shark falls out of the sky. And it's a four-foot shark. Bam! Right in the middle of his putting. And it had a couple of lacerations in it from where some hawk or something had snatched it out of the water and grabbed a hold of it.
Wow.
He threw the shark in his car, raced it to the ocean. He was about 4 miles from the ocean, threw the shark back in the water, and it swam away.
I don't know that I would have picked up the shark.
Well, I think a shark out of water is pretty, you know. He's not looking for a meal so much as he's looking for a little bit of air.
Yeah.
You know, he needs it in some water. But so, you know, who knows how this lake got stocked, but it was absolutely beautiful. And the whole time I'm driving up there, I'm thinking, who built this road? I mean, I can't even enjoy a state or national park the way I used to, because now I want to know who built the road and what were the working conditions.
I've ruined you.
You have. You have.
But going back to
many
the water.
Many a man has tried, but you have succeeded.
I have left that in... Yeah. I'll take that as a badge of honor. But going back to the water, you know, as a diver, you know, I can't imagine untouched, unpolluted. What would be the visibility?
It would be enormous. And that's one of the things that the scientists say about Crater Lake is because it's basically untouched, because you can't put a motorboat in it because it's 2,000 feet of sheer volcanic side to get down into it. And there's a little island in the center of it that will erupt again at some point, and Crater Lake will probably be gone. But because you can't pollute it and you can't get in it, it's like a bellwether for what we're doing with climate change and what we're doing with pollution. You know, nothing can get to Crater Lake that doesn't get there without the atmosphere. Because you can't, you literally...
It's
I mean,
kind
I don't
of like
even,
a Petri dish, then.
Yeah, and I don't even think you could ball up a candy wrapper and get it to fall in the lake because it has these sloping sides. And when we were there, which was June, right, a couple of days ago, the sides were full of snow. So it's pretty breathtaking. It's pretty remarkable. Green, gorgeous, twisted trunks of trees that you know came from the wind just blowing the tree until it twisted around on itself. And breathtaking. And that is really what one of the fun things about this trip is, in addition to what we're learning and in addition to the fantastic people we're meeting, the wonderful, you know, hardworking members of our community all across the country, we get to see some of the nation's most beautiful natural wonders.
Now, will our listeners be able to see some of these pictures on our website, on our Facebook page?
I can't imagine what is going to happen with Carol's pictures when she gets done, because she's got one of those highfalutin fancy pants cameras. But my iPhone pictures are up on, you can go to the People's Store for America page on Facebook and see a bunch of the pictures. Or the Rick Smith Show.
And
just go check
sure
them out.
They get there, because you're right. I mean, this tour has just been, aside from all that we're learning and discovering about labor history, it's just been an amazing snapshot of the country and really the differences throughout the nation, the different sections, the desert, the forests, everything that we've been seeing.
Yeah, I mean, we went to see bodies of water after Crater Lake, and they were the exact opposite, gray. You know, all the surrounding area was ashen, like everything Crater Lake had for brilliance and beauty and bright hue. The other lake bodies we've seen on this sort of trip through the desert as we head east are beautiful but stark in their lack of color. Also, you know, I could use some more friends on Facebook. You can just go find me on Pat LaMarche. And the reason I need you is because, you know, I don't turn people down just because they're neocons. I don't say you can't be my friend just because your head's completely up your butt. But, boy, there are a few people commenting on labor unions on my page that could use a good ass-whooping. So if you feel like getting into the fray, come on over to my page on Facebook, and you're more than welcome to have at it in a couple of these discussions where these people who literally have nothing and no window to throw it out of are saying that, you know, making $40,000 a year is greedy. It's just too much. It's driving business out of the country. What?
I don't understand that mentality.
I don't either. I don't either. And, I, you know, I give it back, but I'm busy. I'm riding all over the country with you.
And this has been, I got to be honest, you know, before we embarked on this, before we headed out, I had a number of people going, you're doing what? and you're going to do it in this amount of time? Are you insane?
Yeah. And
the answer is obviously yes.
Yeah. We were 18 hours in Salt Lake City, and 8 of them we were sleeping. Which, by the way, I appreciate. That was a great night's sleep. We don't get a lot of those.
No.
It was a great RV park, and we get absolutely not dime one from KOA, but I got to tell you, they're reliable. We're traveling around the country, and if you're staying at one of those places, you know you're going to at least have a clean bathroom and the things you need. So we were at one of those in Salt Lake City, and it was just sweet to be able to lay your head down and go.
But what I'm amazed at is the entire crew has not been a mutiny, because I I try and stay on time and keep moving.
A mutiny from us?
Yes.
We have tried to mutiny about four times.
I just missed it?
Yeah. You don't even pay attention. You know, we're burning the Jolly Roger from the mast and all kinds of stuff and nothing. You just keep on rocking.
We got a schedule to keep. We've got people to meet. We've got places to go and stories to bring back to our listeners. And I think that's more important than the mutiny.
I think the way you can get that four-year-old to salute you like a Von Trapp. I mean, I haven't seen this sort of orderly child behavior since Sound of Music.
Uh-oh. You shouldn't have said that.
Why?
Jinx.
Oh, jinx.
We've still got 2 weeks to go.
I want to jinx it. Oh, God, I hated that movie. It was like, let the kids have a life. No, the kids have been wonderful, and you've been wonderful, and Carol's been a saint, and Brett is the unsung hero of this trip, I think, because, you know, you look over at him at any time, and he's all covered with bags and equipment, and he's lugging it back and forth, and, you know, he's putting these shows together and doing it from the top of a cooler lid. He's sitting on a cooler lid at the table in the RV while we go 70 miles down the road, broadcasting, and he's editing, and I try to write on this thing and I can't write, and he hits the right button.
The professionals that we need to bring the stories back to the people we love.
Pretty amazing.
It's
pretty
amazing.
Wonderful
stuff. And you know, and one of these moments where, you know, it's gonna, this is broadcast history. Because nobody is this insane.
It is. You know, when you asked me to do this, this is not my first time in the rodeo. I have actually done cross-country trips in all kinds of crazy situations, not the least of which living in homeless shelters, flying all over the country and pretty fast-paced. But this is the most ambitious thing I have ever undertaken, including running for vice president.
Wow. That's
yeah, I mean, that lasted longer. It was a year-long experiment. This is... Well, this will probably end up being 4 months by the time the book's written, but it is an incredible pace to keep.
Now, with the book, will all the backstories be in there?
You mean all the backstories?
All the backstories.
No,
putting everything, that'll be the second book?
No. Well, the reason I can't put all the backstories in is because some of the backstories aren't any of my business. And if they aren't my business, they aren't anybody else's business either.
Ah.
But there will be a lot of information. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff. I happen to personally love the day that Brett told me he was this far from Plan B, and that if he had his way, he'd be halfway to raising a pig by now.
Is that when we almost got robbed in Las Vegas?
No, I think it was before that.
Oh, it was before that? Actually,
yeah.
I thought it was when we were out participating in the almost robbery, and Brett was going...
Now, the almost robbery will definitely be in the book. The thwarted robbery.
The naivete of my wife?
She's adorable. I gave her a little talking to, too. I said, if I hadn't been in the car, you wouldn't have stopped, right? Oh, no. I'm like, I don't believe you. But... She's too sweet. I know, and that was kind of scary. We're not going to tell you anymore. That is wrong.
You want to buy the book?
Yeah,
absolutely.
But and the guys with the guns in West Virginia.
That was fun as well.
Yeah, and there have been some moments that we probably would have spent more time on if we weren't all working for a. Oh no, that's you. Never mind.
Yeah, that's me.
You're a bit of a taskmaster, and as you said, staying on time has kept us from being able to talk about a lot of the more colorful experiences. But they have been great. But as far as, like, you know, telling too many secrets on the kids or anything, yeah, no, that won't be in the book.
No. Maybe the follow-up.
No, I do think the night that you were trying to get Brett and I a hotel room and it only had one bed probably deserves to be in there. Poor
just
Brett.
Trying to help you out.
Poor Brett. I appreciate that, but you know I'm like 28 years older than he is. Poor fella.
I don't think he'd mind. Going to take a quick break on that note. Back from the People's Tour for America on the road. If you want to follow where we've been, where we're going, peoplestourforamerica.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Don't know much about the science book. Don't know much about the French I took.
eat you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight, on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says the U.S. Supreme Court Defense of Marriage Act and California Prop 8 decisions marks a major moment in American history for equality. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says although the justices ruled on the right side of history, work remains in pursuit of equality. Trumka says continuing to address marriage equality is important, but other major issues for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered workers, like employment discrimination, must also be addressed. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says the U.S. Supreme Court marriage equality decision is a huge cause for celebration for all Americans who care about equal justice under the law. Henry says by affirming that California's Prop 8 is unconstitutional, the U.S. Supreme Court also made it possible for Californians to have the right to marry whoever they choose. The 38,000 members of New York City's Transport Workers Union have embarked on a campaign of zero tolerance for diesel fumes and particulates, even as they are encountering diesel machinery more and more often in their work. Community members are suffering health impacts as well. WIN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
Dr. Frank Goldsmith, who directs occupational health for the TWU, Local 100, says not only buses and subways operate on diesel fuel, but a growing percentage of other machinery, like that used to clean equipment, even though battery-powered equipment is available.
So we've asked the Transit Authority, since all of our members use the same two insurance companies, to do a study of the medical insurance claims of lung cancer through the system, and they have steadfastly refused to do it.
Goldsmith adds that early intervention could save lives.
Lung cancer is usually detected in the stages 3 and 4, when it's almost hopeless to save the person's life. But if you find it in stages 1 and 2, you can eradicate the cancer and the person lives.
MTA spokesman Charles Seaton wrote in an email message that one union request was turned down due to employee privacy concerns, and he was not aware of any request to do a study of medical insurance claims pertaining to lung cancer. Peggy Shepard founded West Harlem Environmental Action, Inc., or WEACT, 25 years ago and serves as its executive director. Several years ago, WEACT conducted a study of 725 pregnant women in the community to assess the impact of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs.
We have seen that over one-third of the cohort of children have developmental delays, low birth weight, and small head circumference due to PAHs in diesel. As a result, we have been able to use that research and advocacy efforts over the years to get the MTA, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, to invest in hybrid diesel vehicles, compressed natural gas buses, as well as the early use of low sulfur fuel.
The Chicago Teachers Union and community allies protested education budget cuts Wednesday, picketing the Chicago Board of Education. They also protested at the Bank of America, which they say continues to gouge Chicago public schools and the city of Chicago with millions of dollars in financially toxic swap deals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. The People's Tour for America. You know, we made it to Salt Lake City and stopped by Sugar House Park. Sugar House Park is famous for having the Sugar House Penitentiary, the place where Joe Hill was executed, sat on a white kitchen chair, and, you know, firing squad shot dead for what we find out now didn't do.
He told them, right? He told them when to fire.
Well, you know, that was the firing squad. He's in the firing squad, and then he said, hey, fire.
Wow. Brave man. I mean, he knew he was going to his death for all the, you know, he didn't deserve to. And he took that last little bit of power away from the people who were going to execute him.
And he had written a little poem before he was murdered and gave it to the prison guards, and they got it out to people. Because, he was loved by a lot of people. And, at the end of it, he said, don't mourn, organize.
Yeah.
And, even in that, thinking about the workers, And I, one of the things I really like about him is that I wouldn't be caught dead in Utah. Get my body out of here. And you know, the story, the backstory about after he was murdered and cremated is they shipped his ashes all over the world.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want to be in the U.S., a place where someone would execute a workers' organizer. And he had his ashes a year afterward scattered all over the world, except in one place. One of the letters got caught up in the U.S. Postal Service, and now there is in the Smithsonian, I believe, a bit of his ashes.
Well, you know, I think that's great that there's a chance for people to remember him better, maybe, because the Smithsonian has him.
Yeah.
What happened to you, by the way? I mean, I'm going here. We have to go find this guy. I'm wandering around a big grassy knoll. Like, that's the second one you've taken me to. And, you know, it's a former prison. I'm thinking maybe it's haunted, you know. And then I'd look around and you're gone.
I was hunting for any remains, anything to tell me that there was a prison there, anything to tell me that this horrific execution happened. Nothing on the execution, but behind some trees, hidden in the back, behind a whole bunch of stuff, you had to go look for it, was one single solitary wall with a little plaque on it of the penitentiary, and we'll have something up on our Facebook page and on the website showing you this little wall with me and the kids in it. And, you know, I was looking for anything that would commemorate, that would memorialize, whatever, but I did find something that didn't, you know, thank people for organ donations.
This is in China. We didn't donate his organs.
Which I thought was a very bizarre place to put, almost on the exact spot where Joe Hill was murdered. They put and maybe there was some thought put into that. I don't know, but I just thought it was very odd. And I understand there's a movement to try and get a monument put up to Joe Hill. Maybe the 100th anniversary in 2015, since he was executed back in 1915. But you had the opportunity to interview Patrick Shea, one of the local historians, a local expert on the issue.
Hey, Patrick, what brought you to Salt Lake City after all?
I think growing up in Utah as a non-Mormon got me to do what I do, and that's seek justice. And my high school is just up the street, named Highland High School, because this area used to be called Highland. And it was a dairy area. And one time my senior year, I went into the principal, who'd gone to high school with my father, and said, let's rename it Joe Hill High School. And he just rolled his eyes because Joe Hill was killed right where we stand at the state prison in 1915. And we're planning to have a national, international contest to build a monument to the injustice that his execution represented. A book just came out 3 years ago that showed that he was involved in a love triangle and he didn't want his mistress to have to testify in court. And he was a member of the International Workers of the World, or the Wobblies.
Okay, hang on, let's back up a little. Who was Joe Hill?
Joe Hill was a Swedish immigrant who had been living in California, had a friend who was a fellow Swede who had been working in Utah. At the time, Utah had a booming mine and smelter industry. And so they came here to work in the mines, and Joe lived in Murray, where my grandfather actually lived, and he is alleged to have killed the grocer and his son. The grocer was also the chief of police of Murray. And at the time, the copper barons who owned all the mines and the LDS Church were very anti-organized labor.
And that's the Latter-day Saints Church, right?
That's correct, referred to as the Mormons. And I'm mulatto. My mother's Mormon. My father was Catholic, so I'm bicultural. But they had a big trial. The President of the United States, President Wilson, the Pope, all asked for clemency for Hill because there was strong belief that he was innocent. But at the time, there was such fervor to execute him that nothing happened, and he was executed on November 15th, 1915.
Now, the president could have commuted that sentence himself, so he asked for clemency but didn't...
Well, at the time, there was a question as to whether the President of the United States could commute a state sentence. He certainly could have under federal law, but it was questionable whether he had authority to do it under state law. And so Utah then, much like now, didn't really register on the federal political scene. But organized labor really used it to make sure people understood that you needed to be together. You need to have solidarity to improve your living conditions.
Now, why does this become a... It sounds like a guy accused of killing a grocer and his child. That's a pretty common accusation across the country. Where's the labor component?
Well, the labor component was Joe Hill was also a great songwriter and wrote some great songs that spread quickly through the labor movement. And he was also, in my judgment, a pretty good publicist. He knew what to say and how to say it. And, you know, history often is written by a convergence of accidents. And I think people at the time were looking, with the onslaught of World War I, for a way of creating a sense of solidarity. And so the labor movement at the time, AFL was separate from the CIO, said this is somebody who we can support. And, you know, Joe said he didn't want to have a single ash of his left in Utah. So the organizers spread his ashes all over the world. Some were taken to London, some were taken to Prague, some were taken to Warsaw as a sign of solidarity.
So you would like to have a more... We're standing at the side of a prison, and I always think, you know, if you were quiet enough, maybe you could hear or sense what happened here, but I don't want to feel that. I can't imagine how...
Part of the irony, too, is that the prison also had imprisoned many of the Mormons who had been practicing polygamy. Because in that 1845 to really when Utah was admitted as a state in 1896, polygamy was one of the two pillars of evil, slavery and polygamy.
So this is where Mitt Romney's dad would have been or grandfather would have been if he hadn't hightailed it to Mexico.
Great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, no, and there are all sorts of hiding places up in Little Cottonwood Canyon and Mill Creek Canyon where the polygamists hid.
So they killed him by firing squad, and was there an outcry locally, like in Salt Lake City at the time?
My grandfather, who was a railroad engineer and member of a union, said no, that the labor movement was pretty intimidated by the bosses and the LDS Church, and so there wasn't much here. There was much greater fervor and mass protests, large parades in Chicago and New York and San Francisco supporting Joe Hill, but within the immediate area, no.
What kind of support or lack of support are you getting for the memorial?
Well, amongst the Utah artist community, we're getting a real expression of interest. The AFL-CIO of Utah has expressed a real interest in participating. And my point is not to rehash some negative part of Utah history, but to remind people in the 21st century that we're the beneficiaries of the hard work and oftentimes suffering and death of early labor organizers like Joe Hill. And we need to remember that history so we don't relive it. And I think in today's world where there's such an incredible disparity of wealth, more than there's ever been in the history of the United States, we need to wake up and realize that whether you're lower class or middle class or even upper class, we live in the same community. And that's what, to me, organized labor has always represented, is the ability to come together, to be incredibly ingenious in solving working problems, but remembering that a 40-hour week is there because the unions made it there. A two-week vacation is there because the unions made it there. And we need to have that reawakening if we're going to be a unified country going into the 21st century.
You know, it's too bad that we don't have more time in Salt Lake City, because you and Rick Smith should really sit down for coffee, because that's exactly why he planned this trip, was so that people could remember the history of the labor movement and not be doomed to repeat it and have to go through those struggles all over again.
Well, I mean, one of the things that anybody who drives on the interstate often thinks that, well, General Eisenhower did that. Well, he did it because he saw the Autobahns in Germany, but it couldn't have been done without organized labor. Teamsters had to participate, the United Mine Workers had to participate. And so if you pick up the telephone today, you can speak the way you do, whether it's on a smartphone or on a hard line phone, because unions help build those systems.
Now, what about the people who say they would have been built cheaper and easier if the unions hadn't gotten in the way?
Well, that's just false consciousness in my mind. That's part of the ruling class's propaganda that somehow the marketplace will take care of everyone. Well, we learned in the 1980s that the trickle-down theory doesn't work. It trickles down to the point that you can't survive if you're below it. And then if you're above it, you forget your relationship to the rest of the people.
Pat, thank you for taking the time. This has been wonderful.
Well, I'm happy, and I just hope that everybody remembers Labor Day for what it really means and celebrates it. We always think of Labor Day as a vacation time, but we need to remember we have it because labor made it happen.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Rick Smith.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Thanks for listening to this encore performance of our People's Tour for America.
Gee, Rick, just listening to the show makes me feel warmer.
Funny, Pat. I feel warmer, too.
Oh, Rick, you should feel warmer. You're in Florida right now on vacation with Carol and the kids.
That's right. But we'll be back after the new year with all new shows and some biting commentary for election year 2014.
I know I speak for everyone when I say I just can't wait.
The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Power when we organize. Power. We stand and fight together. There's power when we organize. Power. When we stand and fight together. There's power when we organize. Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member. GOP, trying to form a plutocracy, but if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. You know, Pat, when I listened to Pat Shea talking about, you know, the Salt Lake area, talking about Joe Hill, you know, it just sends chills down my spine to think that that's our country. That's our history. But it's something that we can't forget.
Well, you know, it's never been... It certainly wasn't invented by the United States of America to persecute the people who stuck up for the average guy. And the sad thing is we think we're such an enlightened nation. We think that we live in an enlightened time and we've overcome these burdens that plagued the Romans or the time of Elizabeth the First or Henry the Eighth when, you know, the peasant was worthless. And but Joe Hill's execution shows that don't stick your head up too far. Don't fight too hard for the average guy because you'll be put back in your place and everybody after you will be afraid to stick their head up too.
And, you know, as I listen to Pat, they're talking about, you know, the church and the local government and the company all kind of colluding together to control power, to control, the people in that area. And I guess it's just not Utah. It was all across the country. But you think about that consolidation of power. You know, I fear that you were moving back toward in that direction.
I would definitely say that the church is now the instrument of the oligarchs. I mean, I would definitely say that that's what the church is doing. Maybe not the Mormon church. Maybe not some of the more progressive churches. But definitely the evangelical church, its goal is to remind people that their reward is in heaven. And that was the role of the Catholic Church during the Middle Ages.
No.
I mean, you don't expect, of course you're in pain, of course you're a peasant, of course you have nothing, of course you have to give up your children to be servants in other people's homes. Of course you do. Your reward's in heaven. And that's the same crap people are being fed today.
And that just blows my mind because, you know, go, well, then if our reward is in heaven, why are you being rewarded today? And then where are you going?
I think you might have come on to something there.
I mean, that's the question we should be asking.
Yeah.
Okay, let me get this straight. If I can't afford to put roof over my head and my kids' head and food on the table, but yet you have all you could possibly ever imagine for generations to come, Where's your generational line going to end up?
I'm not given to quoting religion very often, but it's easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get into heaven. And for some reason, the rich people who profess to be Christians, because that's a Christian precept, they're not paying attention, you know?
Good point.
I thought it was really interesting, though, to be in the on the lawn there in the park where the prison used to be. If you go to those, there are basically two or three prisons that have been decommissioned that are still open. One of them is in Mansfield, Ohio, your old stomping ground, your old stomping area. And that the only reason that prison still stands is because of the movie Shawshank Redemption, Stephen King's movie Shawshank Redemption, where because that was Mansfield Prison was used as the set to pretend to be a prison in Maine, people got together and they got the money to purchase it and stop its dismantling. It was not dismantled the way, was it Sugar House?
Sugar House.
What a name for a prison. Sugar House was dismantled, and the reason, and that area is beautiful, large and beautiful, and down from where Sugar House stood is this beautiful garden area, and that's where the farm used to be, the prison farm, that the prisoners would grow the food that they ate. But it was dismantled so people wouldn't know what went on in there.
Yeah, and the only remnants of it were hidden. You know, because as I stood there, because I've seen pictures of it, I've seen pictures of where the white chair was. So in my mind, I'm viewing these pictures, and I'm standing on the ground looking at the topography, you know, the mountains, the beautiful mountains in the background, imagining you get this building three stories high, and you're surrounded by beauty and majesty and all of this amazing scenery, but you're locked inside these four walls. And I'm just trying to, you know, I'm putting myself in that frame of mind, going, you know, a place of horror like that, in that kind of a beautiful area.
When I was in Mansfield Prison, I went down into solitary, where they will take you. And, good God, that was an awful place. It was in the basement. Tiny, very dark cells. No daylight at all in there because it was in the basement. And people were left there for 6 months, nine months, a year. I mean, you know that this thing happened in prisons all across the country. And like you said, I mean, that's the Folsom Prison Blues. You know, he's in prison and he can hear the train. But like Joe Hill, many of these people were innocent. Many.
And you know, now you look back, and in talking with Pat Shea, you look back and, you know, it was a frame job. And even...
He was a political prisoner.
Yeah.
He was a political prisoner like we hear about them having in the Soviet Union or Russia. Or, I would say now, Gitmo.
But in listening to Pat, and you know, I don't think he went deep enough into it, the international community was appalled, was outraged. You know, the president at the time was asking for clemency. And, you know, there was bloodlust. And more than just that, they wanted to silence that voice. Silence that one person who was standing up and pointing out what was going on.
I think until the United States of America eliminates the death penalty in general, first of all, we're going to have the opportunity for this sort of honor killing kind of thing, you know, where we kill the people who are trying to motivate the small guy. But on top of that, I mean, it was just 2 years ago, October, that they executed that man in Georgia who even the person who said he did it recanted. And the other eight people who were there, they were all teenagers, and they were afraid. And they were afraid of the guy who said that who was the finger man, because he was the one who really did it. And everyone, the Pope, everyone asked for clemency. We're still doing it. It's a blot on our justice system that we have the death penalty.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a death penalty person for so many reasons. One being, I know there are flaws in the system, and you don't want to take someone's life when you're wrong. And the other one is, you know, I was brought up in the Catholic Church. You know, there was one of those Ten Commandments that they instilled in us. And I know there are people who want them plastered all over the walls, and maybe we should remember them. But, you know, thou shalt not kill, to me, means you don't kill.
Everybody. Nobody kills, not even the government. Especially not the government. I mean, that's the reason we don't put the family members on the jury. Of course it's revenge. Of course it's revenge. You couldn't get a fair trial if the family members were on the jury. And so you can't have bloodlust when it comes to the punishment.
Yeah, but you know, I look at this and, you know, having stood in on that ground, I'm hoping and you know, we're going to try and do something to help make sure that there is a monument there. There's some type of recognition, some type of memorial, something to remember, you know, because while I was, you know, looking around and talking to people, I had run into a number of folks and asked them if they knew that there was a penitentiary here. Not even just, you know, I asked them eventually if they knew Joe Ilwa. The younger generation didn't. The older, you know, people, the seniors, they yeah, vaguely. But the younger generation, nothing. And it goes to your point. They dismantle this stuff and they take all the remnants away and they hide a little what they're willing to leave so that, well, we forget and we don't remember.
You know, I think that you mentioned in the last segment, you talked about that little plaque that was in the ground commemorating people who had been organ donors.
Yeah.
I think that was the biggest reason that I could see for why there needs to be a memorial there, why there needs to be some sort of monument. Because I'm willing to bet, you know, my last $5 that the people who put that little plaque in there about organ donors didn't know how close it was to that execution site. And the reason they don't know is because it's not marked. So, you know, if well-meaning people who are trying to just say, you know, hey, thanks for remembering people you can't even know about after you pass by giving your organs up, if those people who are that well-meaning don't know that they just put that plaque right next to an execution site, then nobody's going to know it's an execution site.
It's an excellent point. But, you know, I'm standing there, and I mean, I was struck by the beauty of the area and what a marvelous park this was, and I could see how, you know, you would forget.
Oh, yeah, you'd want to forget, wouldn't you? When you think about the screams coming from the shower room or the screams coming from solitary, when you think about the different things that went on in the chain gangs and other things that were associated with the prison, forgetting is something that human nature would beg you to do.
So what do you think would be a fitting monument? You know, as I was listening to Pat talk, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, just a white kitchen chair. I mean, you know, you look at that and, you know, just something very simple, something, I don't know. I'm interested to see what it is that they're going to come up with.
You know, I know that Joe Hill was a songwriter. Maybe someone should go back through his songs. Maybe there's a symbol in his music. You know, I think, you know, in the way this tour has been the death tour. We did the JFK. We
the
did
martyr
Martin
tour.
Luther King Jr. Yeah, the martyr tour. That's an excellent point. You know, we did this, and we seem to be celebrating the deaths more than we are the lives of the people who died. And I don't mean us personally. I mean the country. When we go to these memorials, it's more about the killers and the way the death happened. It doesn't really seem to be a tribute. I mean, I think that's what the older woman was trying to make the point out in front of the Martin Luther King Jr. Lorraine Motel where he died, was this has really been a James Earl Ray tribute. This is all about the guy that killed him.
Yeah.
And so maybe rather than it revolving around his death, and the white chair, maybe find his music, see what he sang about, do something that would pay tribute to his life's work.
The best line I ever heard about Joe Hill's music is he would steal the hymn songs and then change the words so they made... He'd steal the hymn songs because they were beautiful and pretty, yeah. And he would change the words so they made more sense.
Huh. Like the way they did for the Battle Hymn of the Republic?
Yeah.
Neat.
Just a thought.
Yeah, neat.
But here again, you know, I think back to that and you know, the fire.
Yeah, this guy had some brass.
Yeah. Going to take a quick break from the road. The People's Tour for America rolls on. Quick break, right back after this.
Rick Smith.
Happy holidays, everyone. I'm Rick Smith, and I'd like to invite you to tune in here each and every night through the remainder of 2013 for encore performances of our People's Tour for America.
And I'm Pat LaMarche. I traveled with Rick and his family this past summer on the People's Tour, and we met some pretty amazing folks. So from now until 2014, you'll be able to hear those folks tell their story of how the middle class grew in their part of America. Join us right here weeknights from 9 till midnight.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
I love this country. I should love this state. This feels good being back in Michigan. You know, the trees are the right height. The streets are just like...
There is trouble in the forest, and the features are happening. As the maples scream with passion, and the oaks shall shake their heads.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, the traveling tour that we have been for the last 2.5 weeks. The People's Tour for America, and eventually we're going to make our way to Michigan. We're going to see the place where the trees are the right height.
Trees look like they were the right height in Salt Lake City.
Do they? I thought they looked all different shapes and sizes. Maybe that's why Mitt left.
They were the right height for those trees. You know what I thought was interesting? How little the flowers were. Did you see all those tiny little flowers?
I did.
Lots of tiny flowers. Were the flowers the right height?
I wonder if they imported those.
They looked kind of root-taken. If they imported them, they'd been there a little while. And the public transportation was fantastic, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Light rail.
And, you know, I go back and I read the newspaper while I was there. And they're talking about investing heavily in public transportation, about more than $11 billion more dollars over the next, 30 years. The article I read talked about job creation and, you know, local, how it's going to benefit the local economy. And what caught my attention is it was done by the Chamber of Commerce in the area.
Oh, yeah, the Chamber of Commerce wants you coming into town and spending money, and the best way to get there is on public transportation.
So why don't our elected officials back in Pennsylvania get it? Because, you know, I just read something, they want to gut public transportation.
Well, these guys, you just used a word that is the word that needs to return to the... vernacular of politicians all across the country, which is invest. It's not an expense. It's
See,
an
I think
investment.
They thought it meant incest. Incest. Instead
oh, incest.
Of invest.
Wait a minute. I think incest would appeal to most of our politicians as well.
Well, most of those anyway. But you know what I found interesting, and as I was reading the article, the guy who was the guy quoted in the article, the head of the transportation department for the area, was also a bishop in the Church of Latter-day Saints, the LDS Church.
Well, so is Mitt Romney, who could have been president of the United States. So, I mean, the Mormon Church, some people call it all kinds of names, but it has grown, fastest growing religion in the country. And, you know, it's a force to be reckoned with, especially if it comes, I mean, he was the mayor, he's the governor of Massachusetts. What's his name there, the little chubby guy from New Jersey?
Chris Christie?
Brought up in the Mormon faith.
Really? I
didn't
did not
become
know
a Catholic till he was a teenager. All huh. kinds of stuff going on. Rahm Emanuel also experienced with it. I mean, there are an awful lot of Mormons out there. So those folks didn't happen to. Well, even our last guest, Pat, his mom was a Mormon. His dad was a Catholic. And I asked him how he became a Catholic, and he said his Irish Catholic grandmother took over when he was about 10 and said, that's enough.
We're putting our foot down here.
Yeah. But I picked this up. I went, I'm fascinated by religion. I've had the fabulous opportunity to have been in Salt Lake City about 15 years ago, 18 years ago already. But then, since then, I've gone to Jerusalem and I've gone to Rome, and, you know, capital cities of major religions are fascinating places. And it's interesting because Salt Lake City is also the capital of Utah. And so as we're driving through and we see this fine building on a hill, it wasn't the Mormon temple, it was the State House.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised by that.
And so I was looking through the historical. There's a visitor center for non-believers. See, the believers can go inside the temple, but the non-believers can't. So there's a visitor center for the non-believers, and I went in there, and it had a description of what happened. And it turns out that when Brigham Young, see, they were persecuted everywhere they went. They started out on the East Coast and settled for quite some time in Illinois, and then were shoved along, chased out by the authorities. And they went west, and a lot of people know the famous story about Salt Lake City, and there were all these locusts, and they prayed, and the locusts, then all of a sudden the seagulls arrived and ate the locusts, and they knew that that was the place for them. But Brigham Young, walking around, he's got this wooden staff, and he sticks his staff in the desert. It was a desert at the time. Says, this is where I'm going to build the church. This is where I'm going to build the church. And it's interesting because all the stones were hand-cut. You know, there were artisans that built the whole place. And they believe that every stone is a prayer. Every stone is a prophecy. The entire temple built stone by stone, and each stone matters as part of their religion. I think that's kind of nifty.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, talking about community, each person matters.
Yeah. So then I picked up this thing, The Family, and I don't know if you've seen it. If you watch a lot of TV.
I don't.
I used to. You'll see a lot of public service announcements about being good to your kids, being good to your family.
The Values Foundation.
Well, so the Mormon Church buys, or the Latter-day Saints Church, as they prefer to be called, they buy a lot of airtime and promote the family. So the biggest document I could find there was entitled The Family, A Proclamation to the World. And it was a proclamation by President Gordon B. Hinckley. Now, in the Mormon Church, and some Mormons out there might want to write to me and tell me if I'm wrong, my understanding is there are 12 disciples of the Mormon Church that basically run the place. There are bishops like Romney and this other guy. But Hinckley's the president of the whole shebang. So this was a... we want to clear the air on a few things. So September 23rd, 1995, in Salt Lake City, he made this proclamation. And he said... basically, that everybody had a life before they were born. So you were a spiritual being before you were born. You may not remember that.
No, I don't remember, but yeah. It's nice to know.
And you had a family before you were born. It's kind of an interesting concept, kind of Buddhist.
No.
You know? So your job when you come on this earth is really kind of interesting. In the pre-mortal realm, spirit sons and daughters knew and worshipped God as their eternal father and accepted his plan by which his children could obtain a physical body. So these spirit sons and daughters, loving God, get a physical body. So you're out there hanging out. God gives you a physical body. And the reason they get a physical body is so that they can have earthly experiences that help them progress toward perfection. Who would think an earthly experience would help you get perfection? I mean, of all the pitfalls and tripping things that happen down here. And they ultimately realize their divine destiny as heirs of eternal life. So you've got eternal life, but you're taking it for granted. So they put you here on earth so that you can, like, walk around and say, hey, wait a minute. I liked being a spirit son or daughter a little better. I guess I'm going to appreciate my eternal life, especially now that I've become better at appreciating it. And you go back to heaven. I don't know if that's where the underwear comes in, because they didn't say in the visitor center.
Sounds like a nice story.
And then you read the rest of what he wants you to remember.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Is this where it goes off the rails?
All human beings, male and female. Wait a minute, I thought I was just a spirit a minute ago. Now
we're divided into men and women?
Now all of a sudden my gender is very important.
Okay.
All human beings.
I wonder, do spirits have gender? I mean, are we divided in heaven? I mean, are we divided up into ethnicity and into race and gender? And
well, they do call, this guy, this president, calls you a spirit son or daughter.
So I guess.
Doesn't say spirit kids.
Okay.
All human beings, male and female, are created in the image of God. That's kind of a standard little line.
Well,
nothing new there.
Yeah, but there's nothing new there. But If they're all the same, then how are we different?
Each is a beloved spirit son or daughter of heavenly parents, and as such, each has a divine nature and destiny. And what's the most important part of that?
Money.
Gender.
Gender.
Gender is an essential characteristic of individual premortal, mortal, and eternal identity. Oh, and purpose. Your gender matters. The first commandment.
Wait a second.
What?
So if you were, never mind, go on, please.
So if you were a spirit son and you accidentally got into a girl's body when you got on Earth, and then all of a sudden you woke up and after like 20 years of torment, you said, I really, I'm not happy as a daughter. I'm a spirit son and I'm in the wrong body. I think I'll go for a gender alteration. You know, no, not going to happen in the Mormon church.
But you would think they should, according to that, be happy with that, because now you're just in touch with your inner spirit.
Yeah, you're in touch with, like, you know, oh, wait a minute, hello, sorry, I wasn't really looking, and I guess I got in the wrong. Have you ever used the ladies' room by accident?
Not by accident, no. I've done it a couple of times on purpose.
Maybe some people got the gender wrong. But on purpose. But I certainly have used the men's room bags. I'm like, I'm going to the bathroom. I'm like, wait a minute, where'd the urinal come from? Oops. Right? No. So you get in the wrong line. You're a spirit son. You're getting the daughter's body, right? Next thing you know, you're on Earth. Your gender's all messed up. Oh, no.
See, but here's the difference. If you accidentally walked into a men's room,
yeah,
guys would go, hey, how you doing? Nice to see you here.
That's what happens
a
here,
A guy
too.
Walks into a women's room. They're screaming, and then there are new bracelets.
Did you hear about the tall, strong, fairly rugged-looking woman who went into the ladies' room, used ladies' room at one of the major airports, and security went in and told her to get out. And she's like, what are you talking about? And they said, you've got to get out, but there's no men in the ladies' room. She said, I am a lady.
Wow.
And she showed him.
Really?
She was furious. I wouldn't have shown him.
I wouldn't have shown him.
I'd have been like, mind your own business.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No. She showed him. Anyway, the first commandment that God gave Adam and Eve pertained to their potential for parenthood. I thought the first one was, keep your hands off that cotton-picking tree.
Yeah.
Wasn't that the first one?
Yeah.
It turns out that they're supposed to have children. We declare the means by which mortal life is created to be divinely appointed. We affirm the sanctity of life and its importance of God's eternal plan. And marriage is one man, one woman.
Well, I mean, at least they're consistent.
I got to tell you, they had me right up to gender matters and one man, one woman. Because, you know, hanging out in the ether before and after you're a human.
I'm not against.
Not so bad.
No.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty good.
Love your kids. Don't beat your wife. Don't beat your husband. I like that.
Yeah. Lead a decent life. Be a decent human being. I'm not against it.
If you violate the covenants of chastity or abuse your spouse or offspring, damnation.
And again, I'm not overly against that either. Well, interesting little bit of history.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
I know. Well, you know, it's neat to go to these places.
Yep.
And now I know that
you're not
sure
going to be Mormon.
Yeah, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is relieved, but I won't be becoming one.
There you go. Quick break back at Salt Lake City. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show on the People's Tour for America.
America. Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says the U.S. Supreme Court Defense of Marriage Act and California Prop 8 decisions marks a major moment in American history for equality. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says although the justices ruled on the right side of history, work remains in pursuit of equality. Trumka says continuing to address marriage equality is important, but other major issues for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered workers, like employment discrimination, must also be addressed. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says the U.S. Supreme Court marriage equality decision is a huge cause for celebration for all Americans who care about equal justice under the law. Henry says by affirming that California's Prop 8 is unconstitutional, the U.S. Supreme Court also made it possible for Californians to have the right to marry whoever they choose. The 38,000 members of New York City's Transport Workers Union have embarked on a campaign of zero tolerance for diesel fumes and particulates, even as they are encountering diesel machinery more and more often in their work. Community members are suffering health impacts as well. WIN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
Dr. Frank Goldsmith, who directs occupational health for the TWU, Local 100, says not only buses and subways operate on diesel fuel, but a growing percentage of other machinery, like that used to clean equipment, even though battery-powered equipment is available.
So we asked the Transit Authority, since all of our members use the same two insurance companies, to do a study of the medical insurance claims of lung cancer through the system, and they have steadfastly refused to do it.
Goldsmith adds that early intervention could save lives.
Lung cancer is usually detected in the stages 3 and 4, when it's almost hopeless to save the person's life. But if you find it in stages 1 and 2, you can eradicate the cancer and the person lives.
MTA spokesman Charles Seaton wrote in an email message that one union request was turned down due to employee privacy concerns, and he was not aware of any request to do a study of medical insurance claims pertaining to lung cancer. Peggy Shepherd founded West Harlem Environmental Action, Inc., or WEACT, 25 years ago and serves as its executive director. Several years ago, WEACT conducted a study of 725 pregnant women in the community to assess the impact of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs.
We have seen that over one-third of the cohorted children have developmental delays, low birth weight, and small head circumference due to PAHs in diesel. As a result, we have been able to use that research and advocacy efforts over the years to get the MTA, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, to invest in hybrid diesel vehicles, compressed natural gas buses, as well as the early use of low sulfur fuel.
The Chicago Teachers Union and community allies protested education budget cuts Wednesday, picketing the Chicago Board of Education. They also protested at the Bank of America, which they say continues to gouge Chicago public schools and the city of Chicago with millions of dollars in financially toxic swap deals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A working-class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
You want to witness some change in the counteract? We gotta take the power back!
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. The People's Tour for America has rolled into Salt Lake City, Utah. Along the way, we stopped off at Sugar House Park, Pat, and what a beautiful park. You would have never imagined that place was the site of a massive prison and the assassination or the execution of a labor leader.
You know why the prisons are dismantled, don't you, when they're decommissioned? Because they don't want people to see what went on in them.
So we forget, which is why we have embarked upon this tour, and which is why it's brought us to Utah. And I'm sitting here with Dale Cox. He's the president of the Utah AFL-CIO. Dale, thanks for taking time for us and allowing us into your house.
Thank you for coming. We really appreciate it.
You know, when most people think about Utah, the first thing they obviously think about is Joe Hill and him being executed. But there's so much more to labor history here in Utah. And the reason we embarked on this tour is we want to find some of those things. So we thought it'd be a great opportunity to sit and talk with you about, you know, your history and about the history of the AFL here in Utah.
Well, the history of labor goes way back in the state of Utah. We have one of the biggest copper mines, open pit copper mines in the world. We've had steel plants that have since shut down, just like the rest of the country, all been shipped to China. But we have a rich labor history in the state of Utah, and people just don't know that, or they don't pay attention to that.
Is it that they don't know, or it's been deliberately hidden from them? I mean, you look at education, yeah. You look at textbooks, other than growing up, other than the Molly Maguires, which I learned they were criminals. That's how
education... Well, they treated most labor activists like they were criminals.
I think it's a little bit of both. People aren't educated, and it's our fault because we don't tell our story. That's something we're trying to do with the Utah AFL and the affiliated unions is start to counter. Let them know who we are and what they are or what we are, because a lot of the people of the state of Utah, if you go out and talk to them, they go, oh, there are unions in Utah? They don't realize that. We're everywhere. We're your neighbors. We're your firemen. We're your policemen. We're your school teachers. We drive your kids to school. We build your roads. There's not a day goes by that you're not touched by a union man or woman.
And that's an important point that I think everybody needs to realize. And the question is how did you get to that point? You know, we talk about the weekend. We talk about the 40-hour work week. We talk about all of these things that I think most people of my generation and younger think were just given to us by benevolent corporations. They were just nice.
You know, you're 100% right. And there again, it falls back on our shoulders. We're second, third generation of we've always had it, and we assume everybody else does. And that's not the case. People fought and died for a 40-hour work week, for overtime, for health care. And when you come in out of college or maybe through an apprenticeship program or training program, if you aren't properly educated, you don't realize what it takes to have and to maintain those basic benefits of the middle class, because they weren't given to us. Somebody asked me that question a few weeks ago, and I said, just go back 100 years. You had no overtime. You had no safety. You had 10-year-olds working in factories.
And mines.
It was, and if you're hurt, get out of the way. Starve to death, we'll go on to somebody else. People talk about these pesky government regulations. Well, some of these pesky government regulations, most of them, as a matter of fact, were brought around by unions and the hard work of men and women in unions to make sure when you go to work, you come home as safe as possible. Most jobs are hazardous.
You mean those job-killing regulations? Those job killers?
Dale, how long have you been a member of a union?
All my life, and that's odd in the state of Utah. I started out as an iron worker. Then I was a steel worker for a short time in the mines of Wyoming. Then I became an operating engineer, and I've been an operating engineer for 31 years. I retired as a 31-year member of the operating engineers and came in as president of the AFL-CIO.
Did you ever think you'd see a day when the United States Congress was talking about doing away with overtime?
Never. It's the way they phrase things, you know, right to work. Well, everybody wants a right to work. What it is a right to freeload. It's not a right to work. Overtime, people, it's just ludicrous to me that people would even entertain that notion because, well, it's going to be up to the employee.
It's flexible.
Yeah, it's going to be up to the employee to decide. No, it isn't. I'm a boss. I'm going to come to you and say, you know, I've got 4 hours. Do you want a time and a half or do you want flex time? And you go, well, I'm going to go on vacation. I'd really like the time and a half. Good, go home. How about you? What do you want? Well, I'll take the flex time. I'm sorry, sir. It's not. And the door's been open. The excuse they use, well, it'll never pass the Senate. You know what? May not pass the Senate this time, but that Senate, same Senate, won't be there forever, and the door has been opened.
And that's the important part, all of this stuff, child labor laws. You had Newt Gingrich during the 2012 presidential election saying, you know, get rid of those union janitors and put kids in there cleaning those toilets. And people thought, oh, that's ludicrous, but it's, as you've said, it's opening that door, doing away with the Fair Labor Standards Act. So we need flexibility. It's opening that door. And we see, you know, all of those things we thought 20 years ago impossible, that they mentioned 20 years ago, opening that door, we're seeing a lot of that stuff passing today.
It's amazing that I don't know what it takes to get the American people to wake up, but the middle class is slowly and surely dissolving away. There'll be a have and have-not class. We fought for years, decades, to get a middle class, to hold a middle class. I have mine. I was fortunate enough to work through a time when we had union protection, but it scares me to death. What am I going to leave to my son, my two boys, and their kids? What's it going to be like if they don't have the same opportunities that I have?
Which is the reason we went on this trip. You know, for my kids, what's their future going to be? What history are they being taught? And, you know, to bring this back to the history component of this, you know, you said mining was huge in this area and still is a big component of the area. What were the conditions like 100 years ago for families? What were the conditions like 100 years ago in the mines for my kids?
Well, you know, I have gray hair and wrinkles, but I wasn't here clear 100 years ago. But But I would say, you can smile, that's funny. I would say...
He never smiles.
I would say they are, from just the pictures, you've got a couple here that I've shown you. Times were hard. They worked 16-hour days. They had no safety. If it caved in, they just left them and went another direction. Yeah. And that is what men and women have to realize, is slowly but surely those rights are being taken away.
Because, you know, the reason I think it's important to remember that is to go back and talk about how things were 100 years ago is because I think everything's cyclical.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
We're moving back towards the cycle of company script. We're moving back towards the 16-hour days and the children back in the mines and then whatever in the fast food restaurants or the retail stores today. We're moving back to that. So it's important to remember where we came from, so we don't end up back there again.
Remember when, I think it was Kathy Lee Gifford that really took a beating because her clothes were made in a sweatshop that she was unaware of. Now we have factories in third world countries caving in with people locked in, and the only concern is, oh my God, how am I going to get my shipment? Not why are people doing that, and why am I buying that product?
We went to, we had little flyers printed up back in Pennsylvania for the show. And we went to Macy's, we went to Target, we went to Kohl's, we went to JCPenney, and we went to Foot Locker. And we handed them to the people walking into stores, as long as we could, till we were thrown away. Like, okay, you people have to move on. Managers who were furious that we were telling people that people had died to make their clothing. One person thanked us for telling them. What is it that makes us say 1,127 people can die from my T-shirt? And... you know, it really seems as though people feel like the times are bad and they need a whipping post, and they've decided to whip each other instead of whip the real problem.
You know, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I get a lot of times unions get vilified because you make too much money. Where does that come from?
And how much is too much?
Yeah, how much is too much? What about you don't make enough? You're not being paid properly for your skill set, for what you do every day. For that employer, we're not out to break employers. We're not out. We're in the same boat. I often say we're all in the same boat. It doesn't matter if you're the employer or the man or woman working there. If the boat sinks, we all drown. We have a common denominator, and that's to make the company successful and to be compensated fairly for our skill sets. And that's what's going south now. I got in quite a debate with a legislator last year because they were trying to pass some legislation, and it was actually immigrant legislation to open up the floodgates. And we had like a 7 or 8% unemployment rate. We didn't need that in the first place. And part of his testimony was, well, we feel, or Americans feel like they're entitled. Well, we are. And I'll tell you why. My grandpa worked hard to give my dad a better life. My dad worked hard to give me a better life, and I've worked hard to give my sons a better life and their offspring, but that's all in jeopardy. And if people don't wake up, it'll be too late. They'll be working for, if they don't want to work for $8 an hour, they'll find somebody that will, with no benefits, on a job that's currently paying $20-25 plus benefits.
What was the statistic you quoted yesterday?
The top 10 people in Forbes 500 make as much as every fast food worker in the country. 10 people.
Oh, I don't doubt that a bit. And how much is enough, you know?
And what if that was just the top five? What if we doubled the wages of every fast food worker? The top five, right? Or change it to the top 20, then I guess you'd have to make it. But why is that okay? And when you post that sort of thing on Facebook, people think you're un-American.
I know. They go nuts. It's crazy. And if you pay someone a decent wage, that generates tax revenue. That generates health care. You can either pay it on the bid, or you can pay it in health and human services. You can give a man or a woman a job with dignity and skill and train them, or you can pay it in health and human services. One way or another, it's going to be paid.
Yeah. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Dale Cox, president of the Utah AFL-CIO. They have so graciously invited us into their labor hall here to talk about the history of labor in Utah and current events as well. You know, I'm sure you are aware, Dale, the rest of the country's pursuing this euphemistically called right to work in a number of states. It's in Pennsylvania. It's in a lot of other states. But this whole agenda, this what I call the no rights at work agenda, going after right to work, going after unemployment, workers' compensation, all of those things to tear down and destroy conditions for workers, this is a national agenda, right?
Right, it is. We've been a right to work state now, I'm going to say since 1982, I don't know exactly. But what it is, and I said it a minute ago, it's a right to work for less. It's a right to freeload. It has nothing to do with your ability to work at a union shop. What it has to do with the ability to break the unions. Because all it does is you don't have to join the union, you don't have to pay the dues, but you get all the benefits of that union agreement. And as a union representative, I have to represent you as well as I do one of my union members.
Maybe what we need to do is propose the ability to trade on the stock market without having to pay your trader.
There you go. It's the same thing. I can't go into Costco with that type of deal. If I walked into Costco and said, you know what, I don't want to pay, but I want to shop here, they won't let me. If I go to a restaurant.
If I want to join the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, the Bar Association. If I want to go into a restaurant and all of us go in and eat, and you all pay your bill, and I say, you know what, I'm not going to pay my bill, but thanks for the food. That's what it is. It,
right.
It makes no sense. It has nothing to do with the right to work, because you have a right to work. But you also have an obligation not to freeload. If you're going to be under that union agreement, you should be with your brothers and sisters that are under that union agreement. And our, you know, the number varies, but I'd say 30,000 men and women in the state of Utah that are union members, I am very proud of them, because each and every one of them are union members because they want to be, not because they have to be.
You know, there is, though, this. All these laws have been proposed on behalf of the freeloaders, though. They've all been proposed on behalf of the people who did the Grover Norquist pledge, don't want to pay their share. They think getting something and not paying for it, getting the country, I mean, they move the jobs out, but they don't move their homes away.
No.
They don't leave here.
Well, it's the same thing, you know, with the no new tax pledge. It's nuts. You can't have the services. You know, if I need a fireman or I need a policeman or I want my roads or my sewer or whatever, I want it fixed, but, well, we're not going to raise your taxes. We're just going to do it. It doesn't work. People need to be paid. Roads need to be built. Policemen and firemen need to be trained and equipped so they're safe. And you can't do it with no new taxes. Taxes have to be raised. And this pledge that we're never going to raise taxes is nuts.
That's the other thing that makes me crazy about this whole discussion is union members pay a higher percentage of taxes than people who work for $7 an hour or $7.25 an hour. You're increasing the amount of community you get out of your community because you've got people with better wages who can afford to participate, whereas Walmart employees, disproportional number of them get food stamps. Disproportional number of them get poverty health care. Disproportional number of them are homeless. We are subsidizing these huge power retailers and fast food organizations to underpay workers, and they're financed by the taxpayer.
You're right. Nobody wants to pay more taxes, but you have to if you're going to maintain the type of life that we have. Walmart, just right to work, I'll throw back because I even hate to say Walmart, but I can't even go to Walmart without belonging, you know. It's crazy. Or Sam's Club. It's crazy. But you're right. You can either pay your fair share, you can learn your profession, you can perfect your profession, or I don't know what the alternative is. Unions have been vilified for years. We have the largest training program outside the military in the world. And it costs the taxpayers nothing. We fund everything ourselves.
I have a theory on the reason that unions are under such attack. We were in Wisconsin when that all happened. We were actually sleeping on the floor of the Capitol, and I remember talking to a number of people who said, you know, we learned through union education, because they actually have a labor education component to their public schools in Wisconsin. And the graduate assistants there, who were the first ones to catch on to the budget and all the language and really took to the streets first, said, you know what, when the governor said we're going to call out the National Guard, that took them back to their labor education.
Took them back 50 years or 100 years.
Exactly, right? To where the National Guard came out and or the Army would come out and shoot workers in the back.
Yeah.
And that it was that militancy. It was people who were going to stand up and say, uh-uh, I'm not going to let that happen. I firmly believe that the reason that the right wants to destroy labor unions is because labor is the first one to stand up and say no. They're empowered to say no because of the solidarity and the collective action component to it. So if you've got people who are willing to stand up and say, no, you're not going to cut education, or no, you're not going to gut investment in education or roads and bridges, those people have to be stopped.
I agree with you, and it's amazing. Labor unions, if it weren't for labor unions and if we go away, there will be no middle class. It doesn't matter if you're a member of a labor organization or not. If you're a member of the shrinking middle class, if we go away, you'll go away, and I guarantee that. It's sad but true. We stand up for everyone. Whether you're a union member or not, we stand up for everyone because it's safety and health. If you're working in a non-union shop, you're covered by that same pesky government regulation that saves your life and enables you to go home. We're the ones, unions are the ones, not me, but unions are the ones that brought those regulations forward. People don't realize that. They just are so apathetic. And I hope they wake up before it's too late, because we're doing everything we can. But the middle class, you know, it goes right back to, well, you make too much. No, you don't make enough. You aren't compensated enough for what you do.
Yeah.
And people have to get that mindset.
Do you think it has to go back to the old labor saying, you know, when your stomach's empty, your head gets right? Do you think it has to go to the point?
I hope not, but we're not far from that now.
I mean, because you look at the number of, and we remarked at how many homeless people we've seen in Salt Lake, and I think I think it has a lot to do with that they're allowed to be here. Most communities, it's almost criminal to be homeless. I think that has part of it.
I think you're right. There's a lot of, you know, you just touched something near and dear to my heart, because I'm on the Road Home Board of Directors, and that's the homeless shelter downtown. But a lot of those are men and women that didn't have the opportunities that most people have. And that's what we need to do, is help them, not destroy them and vilify them, but let's help them. Let's raise them to our level and get them jobs and get them training, instead of just, let's give them some money and maybe they'll be out of sight. We can't do that. We're all going to be there if we don't do something soon. And you're right. When your stomach's empty, your brain comes on. Hopefully people will wake up before it gets to that point. We're not asking for the moon. The middle class never wanted the moon. We wanted a fair shake. You know, two cars in every garage, chicken in every pot. We don't want the Malibu house. We just want to be able to educate our kids. We want to be able to feed our kids. We want to be able to raise our children in a safe neighborhood. And we want to be able to be compensated when we go to work fairly. And when we come home, we want to make sure we come home with 10 fingers and 10 toes.
Yeah, simply put, we want to make a living, not a killing.
Yeah.
We were in West Texas, where the fertilizer plant blew up, and it was 500 feet from the elementary school. Every window blown out of the elementary school. Fire burns out of, you know, the marking from the fire burning out of every window in the elementary school, and if the kids had been in school, the story would have been very different. We went by the fire station with the seven men's faces there that died because they went to respond. They did their job, and the place blew up. The elderly home, bed after bed after bed, and the walls blown away from them. I don't hear anything about that.
And I don't know why. I don't either. There's so many things that happen every day, and there again it goes back to the apathy of the American people.
If they'd
rather watch Channel 5 than get involved in the future of their families.
But where are the leaders? I mean, if they had said some fella from a country that we don't like had done it, the leadership would be keeping it on the front page.
You know, and you're right. I talk a lot about this Congress. People come up to me and they're frustrated because this Congress won't do anything. And I told them, why would they? The 2010-2012 Congress was documented as the most ineffective Congress in the history of the United States, and we sent every damn one of them back. Why would they care what we want? I mean, we've made our own bed.
Yep. And it's not going to change until I'm a firm believer we got to get to the streets.
Oh, I agree.
And there's going to be more people, and You know, I look at this thing with Patriot Coal, and on July 9th, we're going to be in Fairmont, West Virginia, with the United Mine Workers. They got a big rally going on to support the retirees who just got their pensions and their health care stolen from them through a bankruptcy judge. And, I mean, it's criminal.
It is criminal. It's like Social Security. It's a entitlement. They just keep saying entitlement. I took on one of my congressmen in our convention last year, in the Democratic convention, and he came in and he started talking about, well, you know, we're going to have to do something with Social Security and the other entitlements. And I went, whoa, let me explain something to you. Social Security is not an entitlement. When I was 16 years old and I got my first real paycheck, they took out FICA, and I asked my dad, what's this? And he says, well, that's your government retirement. They'll take that. And they've taken it out every check since, and my employer is paid into that. That's an earned benefit. It isn't an entitlement, and neither is Medicare.
Well, it's the same thing that they've put in with pensions or health care or anything else.
And it's never affected the budget.
No.
That's the other thing that's irritating, is it's separate money.
Yeah.
They've stolen from it for the budget.
They owe Social Security, but yeah, you're right, they've stolen from it, but that's our money. That's nothing the government has given us. They have put it aside and taken it from the checks, and that's what drives me nuts, is, you know, and everybody in the caucus got excited about it, and the congressman got a little defensive about it, but you know what? That's the truth. But people have to take 5 seconds and think about what they're hearing instead of just go, oh, yeah, well, that's terrible. My Social Security is going to be gone. No, it isn't. It better, by God, be there because you earned it.
It better, by God, be there.
I like that.
You know, it's just like my pension. They say union pensions are too high. Well, that's coming from the people that didn't put anything away during their whole deal. My pension with the operating engineer started at 84 cents an hour, and when I retired, it was $5 and something for every hour I worked was put into that. I didn't buy the new pickup. I didn't buy the new snowmobile. I was putting money in my pension. The ones that are crying are the ones that don't do that, and then they're mad at me because, you know what, I have a pension. Or my brothers and sisters that have done the same thing. We can retire with dignity after a long career. These people don't have anything put away because they spent it all and they didn't have an avenue to put it away, so now they're mad at me. It goes back to the same thing. You didn't do the right thing. We did. It's not our fault.
Yeah, and I go back to the state pensions. You know, those are deferred wages. That's deferred
compensation.
Yeah, it's the
same thing.
That didn't get into the paychecks that those state workers had said, you know what, we want to have a secure retirement.
Yep.
Let me ask you a last line of questioning I got for you, Dale, because, you know, you hit on a couple of things. Utah is a right-to-work state, and I understand Utah is one of the states within the last, I guess, 20 years that did away with prevailing wage, which is one of the big fights going on right now in Pennsylvania. They're talking about changing the definition of construction. We're just going to change Webster's dictionary. We're going to change what construction is so that we can steal wages from people.
Mm-hmm.
So my curiosity is in the places where in your lifetime they've done away with prevailing wage, what has that meant for the building trades? What has it meant for the workers in those industries and for the community?
Well, for the community, they get a less of a product for their money. For the building trades, it's made it very difficult for our contractors, and we have good contractors. The thing, it's made them difficult to compete because they're not playing on an even playing field. But like when I go to the Capitol and I talk to them about prevailing wage or I talk to them about any number of things, it's not just a union contractor because there are good contractors that aren't union. Every time a responsible contractor goes to the bid table, he's punished because he's responsible, because he wants to furnish health care, because he wants to pay his men and women a decent wage, because he wants to train his men and women so they're safe.
And wants to keep them.
And wants to keep them and make them a better employee and a better craftsperson. They're punished because that costs money. And the fly-by-night person that doesn't do that gets the bid. So,
have you seen much of that? Have you seen much transient contractors come in?
Yeah, I see it all the time. See it all the time. But something that I'm very proud of and is even with the outlandish union wages and outlandish union benefits and all the money it costs. When the Olympics came to town, everything was built union. Everything came in under budget and ahead of schedule. Our tracks, our mass transit system, built union, ahead of schedule, under budget. I-15 rebuild, union, ahead of schedule, under budget. With these outlandish wages that my men and women make and the benefits, we still come in under budget and ahead of schedule because we are skilled. We can do it. We get it done right the first time. Are we perfect? No. But we're a hell of a lot more perfect than that man or woman that just gets put on a dozer or on a crane that hasn't had 100 years of background, people teaching them best practices, moving forward. We're much better.
So and since you did away with prevailing wage, let me ask you, because the big selling point in Pennsylvania, and I'm sure you've heard it, and maybe it was one of the selling points that they used back, I think it was 1982, actually,
yeah.
that they did away with your prevailing wage, that you'd save 30% on all building projects. Did the taxpayers save 30%?
No, they didn't save anything. And Dr. Peter Phillips, an economist at the University of Utah, did a study of that. And the thing that sticks in my mind, he's at a construction site, and he says, for you to actually save 30%, every man and woman behind me would have to work for nothing. And they aren't working for nothing. They're being paid. They're being paid less. The state pays more in rework, in my opinion, in rework and in health and safety. And if the men or women that are there that are working don't have insurance, they're going to go someplace. So all with prevailing wage gone, so there's no money for training, no money for health and welfare, no floor for employers to bid, then the men and women have no incentive to continue to work on their trade, because when the job's done, they're gone.
Yeah,
you said it earlier. You said you can either pay it on the bid or you can pay it in health and human services. And I think that's the most important thing that we can remind people of. My background is also poverty and homelessness, and I ran a homeless shelter, and I never had a working union member in a homeless shelter. Never had one. But I had a lot of McDonald's, Burger King, KFC, and Walmart employees.
And it's sad because Walmart's a perfect example. Every time they want to get 3 or 4 more people on Forbes 500 highest list, they just cut their salaries in half and move up. If they're making that much money, don't you think they should at least share it with
Absolutely.
The people that make it for them?
And it comes back down to you and me and everybody else who shops there and all.
Is there a drive in Utah to start organizing the fast food workers or the power retailers?
Not yet. It hasn't got here yet. It's a great idea.
No, there's a movement across the country going on right
now. We're focused on building trades and on public employees. But like I say, a rising tide rises all ships, and we need to get into that area as well.
Dale Cox, we greatly appreciate you inviting us into your hall and inviting us here to talk to you. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad you could make it.
Thanks so much. The People's Tour for America on the road here in Salt Lake City, Utah. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
What do you give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Arrogance is an unpleasant trait, but when it's overlaid with ignorance, it really gets ugly. Meet Arrogance, TransCanada Corporation, a $1.3 billion pipeline giant based in Calgary, is now demanding a U.S. permit to run its Keystone XL pipeline right down our country's center in order to move toxic tar sand sludge some 1,700 miles from northern Canada to export facilities on the Texas Gulf Coast. The environmental threat of this KXL pipe, which would cross thousands of farms, suburbs, and water resources, has been widely reported. Less known, however, is that this foreign corporation has been crudely bullying American farm families and anyone else who dares to oppose its poisonous pursuit of profit. Now, meet ignorance. The Texas Railroad Commission, already infamous for its tail-wagging acceptance of any scam put forth by the corporations it's supposed to regulate. Texas law meekly hands the public's power of eminent domain to certain pipeline companies, allowing them to grab people's land, usually at a lowball price. To get this extraordinary power, however, the grabsters must be, quote, common carriers, meaning their pipelines are essentially public, available to all users. TransCanada's line, however, exists solely for its private gain, so it is not qualified to use eminent domain. Nonetheless, the high-handed Canadian outfit is using it. Sell your property at our price, TransCanada tells landowners, or we'll just take it. How can it get away with this arrogance? Because the so-called watchdog agency benignly accepts any pipeline corporation's word that it is a common carrier. No questions asked. This is Jim Hightower saying, the good news is that such Texans as Julia Trigg Crawford are rebelling. To learn about her gutsy fight, go to standwithjulia.com. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith. Claustrophobia, hypochondria, xenophobia, rolled up into one. Just say in your car, say in mine, and we won't bother anyone. Cause I'm afraid about the temperature.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, one of the of a bunch of things that jumped out of me, jumped out at me from Dale Cox's interview, with the prevailing wage thing. You know, we're told now that, oh, we're going to save 30%. Didn't save a dime.
Yeah.
And in fact, according to him, probably ended up costing more and having to go back and redo the screw-ups of a transient workforce.
Right.
Just grabbed me right.
And untrained. And untrained. Maybe that workforce never moves, you know, 2 feet in any direction or 2 miles in any direction, but they just don't have the training. One of the things he said that I thought was so impressive was the apprenticeship programs of the labor unions in the United States are the largest training program outside the military in the world. So here you have people who are going to get put on the job who are going to be trained to do it properly.
And interestingly enough, and, you know, I had studied a little bit in years past about Utah's prevailing wage when they had done away with it, and all the negative effects. And one of the big negative effects, aside from the fact that there was no savings and in fact actually cost more, was it really harmed their apprenticeship programs and those training programs. Now they do still have a vibrant, growing apprenticeship program, but it's not what it was. And that's, to me, a very important component of this. In Pennsylvania, they've got some amazing training facilities with the different building trades unions that I fear would be in jeopardy.
Oh, if prevailing wage came in, yeah.
Well, I mean, if they're going to do away with the prevailing wage, as they're talking about doing, and look, anytime you open the door, we're just going to change the definition of construction, Pat. That's all. We're going to change construction to where if we only take 2.5 inches off the road, that's road maintenance. And it's not really construction, it's just maintenance. Do you ever think that there's going to be any other work besides 2.5 inches of road work?
Yeah, exactly.
And then
yeah.
How much is that going to cost us doing it time and time again over the long haul?
We had a whole new heating hot water system installed at a place I worked. And it was prevailing wage work. We had had federal money to pay for it, so it was Davis-Bacon and prevailing wage both came to play. And after 2 years, it required maintenance. It probably should have had maintenance after a year, but the place where I worked didn't have it done. So after 2 years, we had to get parts of it fixed and called a local plumber, HVAC guy to come in and do the work. Paid him, wasn't fixed. Called him back, paid him, wasn't fixed. Called back the people that installed it. They charged about twice an hour of the guy that had been there twice and been paid twice and it hadn't been fixed. And in 45 minutes, they fixed it. So, them fixing it, if we hadn't called the other guy the first 2 times, would have been about half the price of the 2 times the other guy came and didn't fix it. But because we did pay that other guy, it ended up being about a quarter of the price, you know, because we wasted all that money on someone who just didn't know didn't know the equipment well enough, didn't know what he was doing well enough. And so you really get what you pay for. Bottom line in the world, ain't nothing for free, and you get what you pay for.
Yeah, that bottom line is you're right. One of the other things that caught my attention is, you know, his talking about Social Security, and he said, you know, it caught my attention is, you know, how they've been stealing from Social Security, and I didn't bring it up, but I remembered Alan Simpson, the senator from Wyoming, saying, you know, it's all gone, you know, we spent it, you know, it's roads and stuff, we used it up, it's gone, get over it.
Yeah. We got something for you to get over. The other thing he said when he was talking about the bids that you know, the higher bids that come from the union shops, he said you can pay for it in the bid or you can pay for it on health and human services. And that really is, I mean, either you pay a wage high enough for a person to buy their own health care, buy their own needs, make sure their own needs are met, or you're going to be giving out food stamps. And you're going to be giving out poverty health care, and you're going to be giving out that stuff.
Not if we do away with those things.
You didn't pay for it on the bid.
Not if we do away with it, and that seems to be the right-wing push. We'll lower the wages down to where you would need health care from the state, and you would need food stamps and LIHEAP and all of the other things. And then once you get that desperate, well, then we'll pull that rug out from underneath you, and then you're just screwed.
Yeah.
Sad, sad stuff. Going to take a quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now. Until the end.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith.
So Rick's off to Florida with his family. We'll be playing encore performances of the People's Tour right through the new year.
No, wait, I'm still here.
Rick, what are you doing here?
Well, Pat, I wanted to make sure that we were playing the People's Tour while I'm gone.
Rick, you and everyone else can rest assured that each night from 9 until midnight, we'll hear some of the very best interviews from our trip across the country, exploring labor history.
Right here, 9 to midnight, on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says the U.S. Supreme Court Defense of Marriage Act and California Prop 8 decisions marks a major moment in American history for equality. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says although the justices ruled on the right side of history, work remains in pursuit of equality. Trumka says continuing to address marriage equality is important, but other major issues for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered workers, like employment discrimination, must also be addressed. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says the U.S. Supreme Court marriage equality decision is a huge cause for celebration for all Americans who care about equal justice under the law. Henry says by affirming that California's Prop 8 is unconstitutional, the U.S. Supreme Court also made it possible for Californians to have the right to marry whoever they choose. The 38,000 members of New York City's Transport Workers Union have embarked on a campaign of zero tolerance for diesel fumes and particulates, even as they are encountering diesel machinery more and more often in their work. Community members are suffering health impacts as well. WIN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
Dr. Frank Goldsmith, who directs occupational health for the TWU, Local 100, says not only buses and subways operate on diesel fuel, but a growing percentage of other machinery, like that used to clean equipment, even though battery-powered equipment is available.
So we've asked the Transit Authority, since all of our members use the same two insurance companies, to do a study of the medical insurance claims of lung cancer through the system, and they have steadfastly refused to do it.
Goldsmith adds that early intervention could save lives.
Lung cancer is usually detected in the stages 3 and 4, when it's almost hopeless to save the person's life. But if you find it in stages 1 and 2, you can eradicate the cancer and the person lives.
MTA spokesman Charles Seaton wrote in an email message that one union request was turned down due to employee privacy concerns, and he was not aware of any request to do a study of medical insurance claims pertaining to lung cancer. Peggy Shepherd founded West Harlem Environmental Action, Inc., or WEACT, 25 years ago and serves as its executive director. Several years ago, WEACT conducted a study of 725 pregnant women in the community to assess the impact of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs.
We have seen that over one-third of the cohorted children have developmental delays, low birth weight, and small head circumference due to PAHs in diesel. As a result, world, we have been able to use that research and advocacy efforts over the years to get the MTA, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, to invest in hybrid diesel vehicles, compressed natural gas buses, as well as the early use of low sulfur fuel.
The Chicago Teachers Union and community allies protested education budget cuts Wednesday, picketing the Chicago Board of Education. They also protested at the Bank of America, which they say continues to gouge Chicago public schools and the city of Chicago with millions of dollars in financially toxic.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program tonight, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. And if you missed any part of our coverage of the People's Tour for America, right there, peoplestourforamerica.com or thericksmithshow.com. It's all right there for your fun, your entertainment, your enjoyment, convenience, all that, Pat, just right there. Pictures, all kind of stuff.
I know. We've been loading stuff fast and furious, and Mary back in Pennsylvania has got little nubs for fingertips from running all the website stuff. But now we're talking to the hub. No wheel can turn without a hub.
Nope.
All these folks that we talk to, these labor union presidents and stuff, they don't go around without the hub of the wheel. And
without the executive assistant to the president and communications director, because as we all know, if you want to get through to the top, you got to go through the important position, the person who takes care of them, and that's Judy Barnett here at the Utah AFL-CIO. Judy, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here. I love the labor movement. It's my family. Yeah.
As
40 years.
Before we came on air, you said all doom and gloom.
Oh, my golly. I'm listening into, you know, the different interviews in the past and all that. And I want to tell you, I've never been more fired up right now with the labor movement. I'm 68 years old. I'm working on my 50th class reunion. And I've seen a change in the last 40 years. And like I said, last week, here at the Union Labor Center, we had 36 pipe fitter apprentices being sworn in. I was stepping over them. And I said to these kids, and they're out there and they have this little book, you know, because they have to learn this, memorize this thing that they're going to raise their hand and swear that they're a member of the union, whatever. I said, what local are you with? He said, well, we're the pipe fitters, which some of us are, you know, some of them have joined, they're going to school. I said, this is amazing. And they're ages 20 to 40-year-olds out there. So I had to tell you, my phone rings daily. Where do I join a union? What can I find out about the unions? And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. I mean, we are getting our message out. At the legislature, we are doing incredible work up at the legislature.
Now, tell us about that. This is Safety Week this week?
Safety Week. I tell you, Senator Karen Maine, whose husband's, was Ed May, the state Fed president for 36 years, the longest running state Fed president. I knew him personally. He passed away 7 years ago. Karen Maine became the state senator. She is working across the aisles with the Republicans. She's had this big resolution signed by Governor Herbert, who's a Republican, for Safety Week. What that means is we are going out, we are offering cash money to all various jobs. Some are union, some are non-union. We're bringing them all together to this amazing convention, and they're going to talk about Safety Week. And when I talk about safety, I think of the picture that's hanging in my office right now. Her name is Hattie Card. She's 7 years old. The picture was taken, she worked in a spindle. She spindled cotton spindles. Worked, what, 12, 14 hours a day? Her biggest challenge is, what if I cut my finger off? Then I can't work in the spindle mines or the spindle fields.
Well, her biggest challenge is not if she cuts off a finger. To me, the biggest challenge is, what the hell is a 7-year-old doing in the
Let me explain. But back then, she can't bring money home to her family. So that's her challenge back there. So I look at that picture every day, and I say to myself, oh, my God, I am so grateful that I've been a single mom for 35 years. I raised two daughters. They both have graduate degrees. One of my daughters works for the mayor here, Democratic mayor, and we work on campaigns hard. We hit the ground running. And if I didn't have the labor unions, I would have gotten into my defined benefit to help them with their education. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it because it's the defined benefit. So I love the labor union. And I think we're doing amazing here in Utah. I know. It's just amazing work in Utah.
Well, we're finding amazing stories. But I want to go back to the 7-year-old girl for a minute.
Yeah.
Because to me, you know, this is a labor history tour.
Yeah.
And, you know, my 11-year-old daughter is sitting here, and I know she knows almost nothing about that young 7-year-old girl who was working in the looms, spinning
what
cotton.
What year was that?
You know, I'm looking on my, my daughter was a history major. She filled this out for me, and she said, the little girl's name is Addie Card. She reports to work just before dawn. She takes her place along her assigned row of machines where she stands and repairs, breaks, and snags to the twirling cotton spindles. So not today and not tomorrow either. Her bare feet will provide no comfort. She works 11 hours. Her thinning and filthy little dress has no protection from the spinning mills. And she comes dangerously close to shredding her skin. But that's not her biggest fear. What ignites in her eyes is a 7-year-old, what if she loses her job in the spinning mill in Vermont in the cotton mills? And she can't. She can no longer provide for her family. And then she's worthless. She can't bring any money home. Maybe she's out on the streets. And often I say, I look into the eyes of that young gal, and I am so grateful. I'm so grateful for what I have and what my children have.
You know, the thing that's awful is when labor unions fought for the rights of the children not to have to get an education instead of a job in a workplace, and when they fought for all these other benefits, greedy multinational corporations who moved beyond Vermont went to other countries where they could put somebody else's 7-year-old to work. And if you've purchased anything at Gap, don't. Gap and Old Navy, Gap especially, is the number one user of child labor in the production of their clothing. There's another young girl like that. She's just in another country.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. What we created here 2 years ago with the help of Senator Karen Main is an organization called Utah Women in Trades. And it's an organization, and what we do is we mentor women, young women, older women, to join the labor unions. And what we talk to them about is that you don't just need a job. You need a career. You need to go to work every day knowing that you have health care, you have a defined benefit, and you have the protection of being harassed on the job, or you have the protection of being, sexual protection on the job. And that's
equally
what we do. Equal pay. Equal pay. These women get equal pay for the same work that a man does
on
the job.
And why is that?
That's because they're under the collective bargaining agreement that guarantees it for them.
The contract.
The contract. We love the contract.
Okay, so do CEOs. You know, I've yet to find a CEO who doesn't have a contract.
That's true.
I know a lot of workers who don't, which is why I keep saying, be like a CEO, have a contract.
Yeah, exactly.
So if someone can hear your voice and they work at one of the places without a labor union, can they call you?
Yes. Well,
what happens? What happens when they call you? They say, look, I'm going to pick on Walmart just by name. I work at Walmart. I don't have any of the things I just heard you talk about. I don't have a retirement. I don't have health care. I have health insurance. It's bought and sold through Walmart, who has their own health insurance company. I don't have anything. What are they going to be told? Are they able to go to work and talk about a union?
Well, if they're at Walmart, they're out of they're SOL'd. If they're at Walmart, I can't help them. But if they want to get a career, I ask them to come to my office, and this is what I ask them. When you're puddling around the house or in the yard, what is your passion? Do you like to fix a light bulb? Do you like to build a door? What do you like to do? What is your passion? And when they tell me, and this conversation happened 2 days ago, the guy said, well, God, you know, I helped my mom pull a toilet, and we did this and that. Boy, that was really cool. I said, pipe fitters, you want to go through the apprenticeship. And that's what I tell them. When they're working at Walmart, I feel sad for them. It breaks my heart. It hurts my heart because they're going nowhere fast. But I understand that because being a single mom, I understand that you've got to do what you have to do to feed your family. So
that is the tough thing.
But, you know, I look at the Walmart situation, and I don't know that you're out of luck. I think at some point there's got to be that groundswell of organizing. There's got to be. And there's a movement right now going on, the Our Walmart campaign and the Raise Up America campaign that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
That I think not just the workers, but all of us could put pressure on the behemoth known as Walmart to make better conditions and to help those workers. I guess I don't take nothing I can do. I think there's always something we should be able to do.
Well, one of the things that we are trying to do right now is education, education, education to our members,
right,
to the rank and file. Because when I hear from our member, oh, yeah, I just went to Walmart, got this great thing on sale, I'm thinking we're not doing our job. We're just not. You know, Sam's Club, Walmart, we're slipping it. So at our conventions, we have all Made in the USA products. We have special drawings. We try and educate, and it's just, you know, educating them. When you educate the rank and file, then you educate their families and their parents. It goes on and on.
So. Yeah, because, you know, it's one thing just to talk to your members. It's another thing to be talking to everyone because, you know, at the end of the day, you are the voice of workers in this country. You're the lone group for the working class. And it's just not a member idea to me. It's, you know, when you fight for a minimum wage, I don't know very many union members who make minimum wage. When you fight for better hours, better conditions, safety, you know, safety week as you put out, you know, there's part of me, Judy, that goes, you know, why do I want to fight for any of that stuff? Why as a union member do I want you fighting for minimum wage? Why do I want you fighting for any of that stuff? Safety on the job, any of that, when we should be sitting down at the bargaining table and negotiating that stuff.
Why should we as
a
union?
Yeah, I mean, you've got contracts. I mean, you know, negotiate stuff.
Now I'm under collective bargaining.
You negotiate all of that stuff. Why do I want to do that for anyone? Why do I want the state doing it?
Oh, no, because...
Why do I care about someone who's not a member?
Because I care about any brother and sister out there. It's the right thing to do. I care. I don't care where you're from or, you know, what faith you are. I don't care what your sexual preference is. It doesn't matter to me. We're all human beings, and we all deserve the same.
Fabulous. One last question. Is Senator Maines, is that her name?
Senator Karen Maine.
Mm-hmm. Now, is she the only one is she a lone wolf, or can we, like, clone her? What's the deal with her?
Oh, she's amazing. You can certainly clone her, and she's just a firecracker. But, you know, and she's a personal friend of mine, too. As you can see, I've known her for over 40 years. But what Karen does and what she's been able to accomplish is that she talks to the Republican legislators up there and almost shames them. Shame on you, you know, in not seeing that this is the right thing to do. It's not a union bill. It's a working families bill.
Right.
Or it's a family's problem. Because every time she stands up there, she has to show them that, yeah, maybe I'm from the House of Labor, but it's a working families. You know, shame on you that we should go back to the history.
And I think that's important that you point that out, Pete, because, you know, what's going on is the right and the wealth class of this country has tried to pigeonhole labor into narrow self-interest. And the reason I ask that question is because there's a school of thought that says labor shouldn't be doing anything on minimum wage or any social things. That it's all the stuff we should be negotiating at the table. And I think you've got the right idea, is that, you know, it's for the benefit of all society, and that's counter to what the right wing keeps pushing down our throat.
Yeah. And, you know, here in Utah, we have what we call the LDS Democrats. And what was interesting is they're kind of trying to put the doctrine of the LDS or the Christians together with what our philosophy with the unions are. And what scripture comes to mind, which is not much that I would know, is that in as much as you do it for my brother, you do it for me. Now, how more can that be inclusive? It doesn't seem my brother who is black or white or not gay or my sister. It says in that we do it to the least of our brother, you do it to me. And amen to that, I say. That's what we're about. So we're trying to put the two together and show how they parallel and how that's what we're about. We work with United Way. United Way is about helping families. That's what we do. We have a food pantry right down the hall here. It is stocked, and we help our brothers and sisters that are out of work. So that's why I'm getting close to the end of my time. I am getting close to the end of my labor working career. But I look back on it, and I am so grateful for the journey. And I am preaching the message as far as I can. I'm very grateful.
Judy, I can't imagine, even if you retired, that you would ever stop the work that seems to be your passion.
Maybe she needs to go to the Utah Senate and help.
Yeah,
Senator Maines.
Senator Maine, we could be the women up there, but she is. She's a cracker barrel, and we love her.
Run for office.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that one before, too. I, well, actually, I am. I've already been. I'm elected. I'm on the East Mill Creek Community Council, of course, I am.
Those are just as important in my view.
The little council, so I'm there. We're fighting for it.
Judy Barnett, we appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thanks for asking me, you guys.
Let's take a quick break right back from Salt Lake City, Utah. We're right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history. Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says the U.S. Supreme Court Defense of Marriage Act and California Prop 8 decisions marks a major moment in American history for equality. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says although the justices ruled on the right side of history, work remains in pursuit of equality. Trumka says continuing to address marriage equality is important, but other major issues for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered workers, like employment discrimination, must also be addressed. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says the U.S. Supreme Court marriage equality decision is a huge cause for celebration for all Americans who care about equal justice under the law. Henry says by affirming that California's Prop 8 is unconstitutional, the U.S. Supreme Court also made it possible for Californians to have the right to marry whoever they choose. The 38,000 members of New York City's Transport Workers Union have embarked on a campaign of zero tolerance for diesel fumes and particulates, even as they are encountering diesel machinery more and more often in their work. Community members are suffering health impacts as well. WIN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
Dr. Frank Goldsmith, who directs occupational health for the TWU, Local 100, says not only buses and subways operate on diesel fuel, but a growing percentage of other machinery, like that used to clean equipment, even though battery-powered equipment is available.
So we've asked the Transit Authority, since all of our members use the same two insurance companies, to do a study of the medical insurance claims of lung cancer through the system, and they have steadfastly refused to do it.
Goldsmith adds that early intervention could save lives.
Lung cancer is usually detected in the stages 3 and 4, when it's almost hopeless to save the person's life. But if you find it in stages 1 and 2, you can eradicate the cancer and the person lives.
MTA spokesman Charles Seaton wrote in an email message that one union request was turned down due to employee privacy concerns, and he was not aware of any request to do a study of medical insurance claims pertaining to lung cancer. Peggy Shepard founded West Harlem Environmental Action, Inc., or WEACT, 25 years ago and serves as its executive director. Several years ago, WEACT conducted a study of 725 pregnant women in the community to assess the impact of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs.
We have seen that over one-third of the cohorted children have developmental delays, low birth weight, and small head circumference due to PAHs in diesel. As a result, we have been able to use that research and advocacy efforts over the years to get the MTA, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, to invest in hybrid diesel vehicles, compressed natural gas buses, as well as the early use of low sulfur fuel.
The Chicago Teachers Union and community allies protested education budget cuts Wednesday, picketing the Chicago Board of Education. They also protested at the Bank of America, which they say continues to gouge Chicago public schools and the city of Chicago with millions of dollars in financially toxic swap deals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
You want the weakness of change in the counteract? We gotta take the power back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, the People's Tour for America here in Salt Lake City, Utah. You know, as we pulled in, I saw this amazing sight. Streetcars. like trains where people, public transportation for people to get around. I'm going, wow, someone who gets it. I mean, we can't get a train from where we live.
Oh, no, heaven knows. And you know, by the way, I'd just like everyone to know that the bus stops at 6:30. That's not public transportation. That's like a curfew.
But, you know, I'm looking at this, and, you know, I happen to see the Salt Lake Tribune, and right on the front page, they're talking about investing in public transportation. Well, you know, I bring it back to us. You know, our governor and the Republicans in Pennsylvania talking about gutting public transportation. Here in Salt Lake City, they're talking about $11.3 billion they're going to try and raise in property taxes over the next 3 years to invest in public transportation. Really?
I wonder how how is that going over with people?
Well, they claim it's going to create 182,000 jobs. It's going to bring in about $22.2 billion in tax revenue from economic growth. It's going to add, you know, billions, $130 billion to household incomes, a whole bunch of very positive things. But you know, here again, you got to think down the road for that to happen.
And these jobs are?
Hopefully good-paying union jobs, and hopefully, since they're public transportation, hopefully members of the ATU, the Amalgamated Transit Union, and I'm sitting here with Norm Blesent. He is the Secretary-Treasurer of ATU Local 382 here in Salt Lake City. Norm, thanks for taking time for us.
You bet.
So what do you think of this? I mean, actually investing some money in public transportation, it's got to be great news.
It is. As Blaise was talking earlier, we're working under an expired contract, so hopefully this will help us get a new contract.
And maybe add some members and a whole bunch of good things that come out of this.
Absolutely.
You know, I saw, you know, like I said at the beginning, I saw these trains going by. I saw public transportation. I'm going, a place that gets it. How did that come to pass?
A lot of the trains were done 2002, I believe, for the Olympics. Was one of the big kickers for it. And now we have light rail, heavy rail, and they are going to do a streetcar.
Nice.
Now, you said that you're not operating under a contract right now.
Expired contract.
Okay. So does that make it more difficult to get your job done? Or?
No, they're just operating under the same contract. It's
right.
Just expired. They're just working under the terms of the old one.
Right. So
we haven't had a raise since 2011.
So this has got to be good news that they're going to be investing in it, because now they're talking about, hey, there's going to be some money available.
Possibly. We're actually going to fact-finding. So
is this something that's being I mean, it's on the front page of the paper locally today, but is that something that's well-received?
I don't know. I didn't even know it was in the front page of the paper today, to be honest with you.
Well, I mean, just public transportation as a whole, I would guess, in this area is something, because you know, the traffic here, not as bad as it is in Harrisburg, not as bad as it is in a lot of places that we've been in. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that there is a good public transportation system. Let's talk about the history of ATU here in Salt Lake, Norm. You know, how far back do you guys go?
We were founded in April of 1904 when we were the streetcar rail workers, and then it's progressed since then. Now we're the Amalgamated Transit Union. We do buses, trains, mechanics, drivers, the whole nine.
So when I use public transportation, you're my guy?
Yep.
And, you know, what I find important about that is, you know, these are trained professionals. And I understand you guys have a pretty good training program that goes along with this where you work on safety and career development.
In our maintenance department, we have an apprenticeship program that's for bus mechanics that's top-notch. It's federally sponsored, recognized, the whole nine. The rail, they're working on getting something like that. And our bus drivers have their regular training that they do.
You know what I'm thinking about is Memphis, where those guys are hanging on by their fingernails. They're talking about cutting everything to the point where they're going to have to eliminate service sometimes a day and certain days of the week, and they're going to cut back. And, you know, you think about how short-sighted that is, especially with fuel prices at, well, in California, way over $4 a gallon, but expensive, and it's really only going to hurt the poor working stiff.
Right, and they have cut routes here, too. Just not to the extent of like in Pittsburgh and some other places, but they have cut some routes and stuff.
Now, are they talking about privatization here? Because like in Pittsburgh, you know, they went and they privatized the really profitable routes. And then they found out, well, gee, we charge so much money that people went to the other routes. Just an interesting little experiment. I mean, really a very interesting little experiment.
We haven't got into that yet. I mean, I think the legislation talked about it real brief, but nothing major, like you said, fortunately. So that's where we're at with that for now.
So walk me through the 1904, you're the streetcar folks. You know, how do you get into the bus lines? How does all this work? People just organize?
Yeah, it was before my time, you know.
So in your time in the area, walk me through your time. What got you involved in this?
I started in 1990, and, you know, family's always been involved in unions where I'm from, so it's what you do. You join the union, and I got involved. I was a shop steward and then executive board for probably 17 years, and then I got into the was elected into the position I'm in now, and 3 years ago.
So where are you from? You're not from Salt Lake originally?
No.
I'm going to say Northwest.
Kansas.
Kansas.
Right on the Missouri border. So
your family members, union members?
Absolutely. United Mine Workers.
So something that was passed down through the generations. Because what we're finding out is, you know, we talk to a lot of people who, you know, they're second, third, fourth, fifth generation union members. That the history of their particular union has been passed down from generation to generation. So I'm curious, in your upbringing, in the, you know, what did your father pass down to you? What did your grandparents pass down to you?
My grandfather was a United Mine Worker union member for 75 years. My dad was a union member until he retired, or got laid off, actually, from a produce company. And then I said I joined the Army and got out of the Army, worked here, and ever since.
What do you think of what's going on with, I don't know if you've been following the Patriot Coal situation where the bankruptcy judge just wiped away the retirees' pension and health care. You know, as you know, the grandson of a miner, you know, what do you think of what's going on with these miners?
Well, that's just totally wrong. You can't take what they worked and earned their whole life for.
I mean, to me, it's criminal.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and going back to some of the stories that they passed down to you, and I'm sure that you'll pass down to your children, you know, I look around and I don't see that kind of labor education going on anywhere else but in the families. And, you know, the sad reality is I don't even know sometimes that it's being passed down, because I remember my grandfather telling me all the horror stories that he went through, but told me if I ever became a truck driver that I'd be a failure, because he wanted better for the next generation.
Right. My son, he's a member of the Teamsters with UPS. So my other son, they don't have a union where he's at. So
that's part of it as well. You know, but one of the things that I look at this area, and it's like any area. And what we've found is there's a lot of history in this area that, you know, we didn't know. Other than, you know, when I thought of Utah, you think Joe Hill. Everyone knows Sugar House Park. Everyone knows, you know, executed. Beyond that, not much more that I knew before. And now there's a bunch of things that we've learned along this route. Norm, it's been great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
And thank you.
I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Hard times are going around, bringing hard luck on New York town. Well, I'm banking on the 18, banking on the 18. I'm banking on the 18.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
What do you give a guy who has everything?
Labor history, of course.
And where can you get a great dose of labor history?
Right here, weeknights from 9 to midnight on The Rick Smith Show.
From New York City factories to West Virginia coal mines to Oregon loading docks to Toledo glass factories, you'll hear all the stories right here, right up until the new year.
And then we'll be back with all new shows here on The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We are in Salt Lake City, Utah, the People's Tour for America. And if you want to find out where we're going next, peoplestourforamerica.com, or if you missed any portion of our tour thus far, it's been a long couple of weeks. Actually, it seems really quickly. I mean, I almost don't remember the beginning.
Yeah, it's the 20 days that feel like 20 years, but we can only remember 20 minutes of it.
Exactly. I mean, that seems to be what it is. And I can't wait forward to the, I can't wait for the next minute.
Yeah.
I mean, we are learning so much. And, you know, at the beginning when I thought of this, I thought we'd get it all down. You know, we'd go through the tour, we'd experience it, it'd be good. We'd be able to put everything down on paper, it'd be done at the end. But we're going to have to go back and spend a whole bunch of time revisiting each site and talking to people again and again, because there's just so much.
And when I think about the research that's going to be necessary to write this book.
Glad you're writing it.
Every time we
meet somebody new and they tell me some new facet, like the last interview where we just talked about McCarthy and McCarthyism affecting the labor unions. I'm like, oh, God, no, no.
There's another
angle. We go through the whole Red Scare. yeah. Okay, so War and Peace will be ready sometime in the fall. Make sure you reserve your copy now through the Rick Smith Show.
There you go. We're here in the Union Center here in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I've got Brandon Drew.
Oh, my God, you said you were not going to mess his name up because it was too easy.
He said it. He did say it, and it put it in my head. I've got Brandon Dew here sitting with us. He is the president of Central Utah Federation of Labor. Brandon, thanks for taking time for us.
You bet. Happy to be here.
I'm sorry for screwing up.
That's all right. I put it in your head, so it was bound to happen.
So let's talk about your – it was. It's there.
It's banging around in there all
now
lonely.
Now it's never going to leave. So you're the president of the Central Utah Federation of Labor. Tell me, what is that?
Well, the Central Utah Federation of Labor is a group of unions that get together, almost a union within union, get together for common cause, which is to make unions stronger, but also to get politically active and help candidates that are like-minded get elected.
You know, I when we announced we were doing this tour, we've gone through a number of southern states, and of course here into Utah, and, you know, I've had people go, are there unions in those places?
Right. Yeah, I get that all the time. I didn't even know there was unions in Utah, but we're here, we're active, we're strong, and trying to make a difference.
And as we've been finding out, an awful lot of history in this area, and you know, and a lot, really a number of great people we've met like you. So let me ask you, how did you get involved in this? How did you get to this position?
Well, it was it's kind of interesting. My journey is kind of a long one. I'm only 38 years old, but I got involved in the labor movement through some good people that I worked with. So my dad was an accountant, so I wasn't raised in a union household.
What does he think about you being like the chief poobah of the union crowd now?
Well, he's a very staunch Republican, not anti-union, but not really pro-union. I think he's probably neutral. He thinks it's neat that I'm in a job where I can affect people's lives. So to that end, I think he's proud of what I do, but in the career that he's involved in, there's just not a lot of unions, no unions in really the accounting industry. So
I'm curious, you know, in your upbringing, because, you know, personally, you know, I always saw union equals path to the middle class. What was the messaging, or was there any in your years growing up?
None in my years growing up. My dad was in very white collar type atmosphere, which generally you just don't have a lot of unions in those type of
professions. Which I think we should.
We should, absolutely. A lot of your government-type entities have some unions, public employee-type unions, but in the household I was in, it just wasn't really spoken about. I learned, you know, the few things that you hear in high school and in middle school and stuff like that about unions, but usually those are the negative side of unions and strikes and those sorts of things instead of the positive and why unions came around in the first place and all that we've got out of unions. So.
Well, and the negatives, the strikes and all that, as you put it, the negatives were because they didn't have a choice in a lot of cases.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, that your back is against the wall. You've got no choice if you want to improve your future. So
you get to this, and now you're the head guy there. And I'm curious the path. I mean, because, you know, it seems to me very, very, a very interesting path.
He had to get a bunch of people that did have this five generations of their family
exactly.
to vote for him.
Yeah, we've, you know, it's been interesting as I've gotten involved. I had a lot of good people that surrounded me when I was a diesel mechanic by trade. And so when I went into the company that I was working for, I knew nothing about unions. So the individuals around me drug me to union meetings. And when I say drug, it wasn't in the literal sense, but hey, you need to come with us to this meeting. And I found that I really enjoyed the camaraderie with the guys and the ladies that I was hanging out with and what unions were for. And kind of one thing led to another. I started getting involved politically, got involved with my union, became a job steward on my job site. And, you know, the next thing I knew is the union was offering me a job as a union organizer. And I was 25 years old at the time. And here I am 13 years later and very active in the union movement here in Utah, and so I'm happy to do that.
So how do we reach the next generation? Because, you know, as we've been finding out, you know, look, my grandparents passed it down to my parents' generation, who passed it down to me because they were in those kind of jobs. There's been that break from my generation, you know, between us. How do we reach that next generation?
Well, I think we just have to keep speaking about what unions are here for. You know, I think over the generations, probably couple generations ago when unions were strong, people understood what unions were there for. And now a lot of the current generation and those underneath us take what we have for granted. And then we see those things slowly eroding away. And I unfortunately, I think we're going to have to hit bottom before a lot of people step up and realize that there's a reason for unions, that we're here for a purpose, and that our purpose is to help the middle class.
Now, you said that you like to get like-minded people elected, which from your lips to everybody else's ears, I swear. But what happens when you get them elected and they're not like-minded anymore? That's what's really frosted my cookies lately. And you got a bunch of pictures of the commander-in-chief around here and cutting Social Security? I mean, that is so unlike-minded. What happens then?
Well, I think we have to hold our elected officials responsible for what they're doing. And we, you know, here in Utah, it's a red state. It's not red. It's maroon. I mean, it's, you know, as far right as you can get pretty much. But we in the labor movement here have found that people on the right, we can find people on the right that are like-minded as well. But you have to reach out to them and explain what it is to be union, why we take care of our own, that when we have unions that we're not on, you know, the Medicare rolls and stuff like that because we're taking care of our own people. And I think that's what it is. Just like communicating with the youth of our generations, we need to speak to these politicians, help them understand why labor is important. And getting back to your point, we have people within our own state that are left-leaning that have voted against us on many issues, most recently on the overtime provisions. And we have to step up and let those individuals know why we're disappointed in those decisions, and then also hold them accountable and find other candidates that could run in those positions to take over.
You know, Brandon, I look at the conditions right now, and, you know, right now, organizing, as a former organizing, now is ripe time, because you've got a generation of young people who are saddled with massive debt. You've got a large service sector economy that's fallen behind even further than they were when they started. It just seems to me that now it's ripe for organizing, and that there should be a groundswell of support. And sadly, I'm not seeing that groundswell of people who have said, you know what, I've had enough. There's only so much of you-know-what I'm willing to eat, and I've had enough.
Yeah. Well, I think part of that is really we as unions don't do very good about publicizing ourselves. We allow a lot of entities to say who we are. We don't tell people who we are. We're not the guys out there with the Louisville Slugger bats, you know, pushing people in the back of a Cadillac. We're out there on a day-to-day basis working for the middle class, for the men and women in the middle class, to help them have a better life. And we're not really good about publicizing that. We do it. We're quiet about it. We do a lot of charity work, taking care of the homeless here in Salt Lake and things like that. And we don't, you know, toot our own horns. So some of that falls back on us. We have to do a better job of letting the middle class know that we're here. And we
you don't have
that.
A Madison Avenue PR firm?
Well, that's part of the issue is over the years we've seen, you know, the stock market is at the highest it's ever been, and wages are at some of the lowest they've ever been. And so,
not some of the lowest, the lowest.
That's exactly right. So until we're able to get people back on track, get this country back on track, and getting people elected that want to bring the middle class back up to where we should be, it's going to be a tough row.
Yeah, and, you know, I look at that next generation, which I believe ripe for organizing. All those fast food workers, you know, and we're seeing the campaigns around the country. We've seen the Walmart people who are trying. There's just got to be a huge push of groundswell support from folks like you and me and our listeners.
Absolutely. You know, if we continue to go down the path, we won't have much of America left. So, you know, we've always envisioned ourselves as the leaders of the free world, and before long, there's not going to be much freedom here left.
Well, I say we're going to end up back, you know, in the last interview we talked with Wayne Holland Sr., and, you know, back to company script, back to, you know, the company store, the company towns, and if you're not playing along, out of the company town you go.
Well, that's why we got Walmart. That's the new company store. So they come in and run every mom-and-pop shop out of town, and, you know, before long, you don't have any left.
And then they do your income taxes, and your check is issued at Walmart, and you never make it out of the store with it. But you don't even have to wait for the post office right now. But you don't even have to wait for the post office. I mean, they're already doing it right now with your income tax return. But that's something that really, if I could make a recommendation, you do need the Madison Avenue campaign. there are people who will drive to McDonald's right now and shop and eat there as though it were good for them. And that's because of advertising. And that is how powerful it is. And we went to the Dockers convention in New York a couple of weeks ago. And it is horrifying to be progressive talk radio hosts in a room full of people that have destroyed this country. They are the people on the radio who have destroyed this country. And our side doesn't have enough Rick Smiths. I'm not a Rick Smith. I'm Pat LaMarsh. I'm completely separate. But there are not enough Rick Smiths, and there isn't enough of a voice like his or his voice around the country. And it's frustrating because they have so many Ann Coulters and Rush Limbaughs, and that's what's happening, really, I think, to the opinion of labor unions.
Well, yeah, big business is the backbone of the Rush Limbaugh-type programs, you know. So they're paying for those programs, and those programs have a lot of money behind them.
You know what they told us? We were sitting there like spies in this big auditorium, and they're talking about how they saved Rush Limbaugh's revenue. Now, of course, he lost his revenue because of the Sandra fluke, right? He spoke.
It wasn't a fluke. He just spoke what he meant.
He spoke about that woman in such a horrible way, and literally, they said advertising agencies would not even let them say the name Rush Limbaugh when they came to make a pitch. They couldn't. So you know what they did? They went for private money. Unknown, undisclosed people who just paid money to keep him on the air. That's disgusting.
Yeah, I agree. But that's the world we live in. Big money is now purchasing politicians and purchasing our television and radio networks. So,
but at the end of it, Brandon, there are more of us. We've out-procreated their money. There are more of us than them.
That's
and
right.
We need to be able to get into the streets. And I'm a big fan of In the Streets. And you've heard me say it before.
We've appropriated their money.
We've appropriated them and
that,
their money.
That needs to be a bumper sticker.
As long as it's got the union bug on it, I don't care what you print.
There you go. There you go. That sounds good.
Brendan Dew, I appreciate the time. President of the Central Utah Federation of Labor. It was great talking with you. Thanks so much.
You as well. Thank you.
Got to take a quick break here from Salt Lake City, Utah. The People's Tour for America on the road right back after this.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Happy holidays, everyone. I'm Rick Smith, and I'd like to invite you to tune in here each and every night through the remainder of 2013 for encore performances of our People's Tour for America.
And I'm Pat LaMarsh. I traveled with Rick and his family this past summer on the People's Tour, and we met some pretty amazing folks. So from now until 2014, you'll be able to hear those folks tell their story of how the middle class grew in their part of America. Join us right here weeknights from 9 till midnight.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says the U.S. Supreme Court Defense of Marriage Act and California Prop 8 decisions marks a major moment in American history for equality. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says although the justices ruled on the right side of history, work remains in pursuit of equality. Trumka says continuing to address marriage equality is important, but other major issues for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered workers, like employment discrimination, must also be addressed. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says the U.S. Supreme Court marriage equality decision is a huge cause for celebration for all Americans who care about equal justice under the law. Henry says by affirming that California's Prop 8 is unconstitutional, the U.S. Supreme Court also made it possible for Californians to have the right to marry whoever they choose. The 38,000 members of New York City's Transport Workers Union have embarked on a campaign of zero tolerance for diesel fumes and particulates, even as they are encountering diesel machinery more and more often in their work. Community members are suffering health impacts as well. WIN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
Dr. Frank Goldsmith, who directs occupational health for the TWU, Local 100, says not only buses and subways operate on diesel fuel, but a growing percentage of other machinery, like that used to clean equipment, even though battery-powered equipment is available.
So we've asked the Transit Authority, since all of our members use the same two insurance companies, to do a study of the medical insurance claims of lung cancer through the system, and they have steadfastly refused to do it.
Goldsmith adds that early intervention could save lives.
Lung cancer is usually detected in the stages 3 and 4, when it's almost hopeless to save the person's life. But if you find it in stages 1 and 2, you can eradicate the cancer and the person lives.
MTA spokesman Charles Seaton wrote in an email message that one union request was turned down due to employee privacy concerns, and he was not aware of any request to do a study of medical insurance claims pertaining to lung cancer. Peggy Shepherd founded West Harlem Environmental Action, Inc., or WEACT, 25 years ago and serves as its executive director. Several years ago, WEACT conducted a study of 725 pregnant women in the community to assess the impact of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs.
We have seen that over one-third of the cohorted children have developmental delays, low birth weight, and small head circumference due to PAHs in diesel. As a result, we have been able to use that research and advocacy efforts over the years to get the MTA, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, to invest in hybrid diesel vehicles, compressed natural gas buses, as well as the early use of low.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. You can also follow us, The People's Tour for America. Find out where we've been, where we're going. The folks that we've spoken to, lots of photos, lots of opportunities to interact. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, email us, Rick at therickssmithshow.com. Lots of ways to be involved. I'm sitting here with Wayne Holland Sr. We are in Salt Lake City, Utah. And the idea of this, Wayne, and I appreciate you coming and sitting down with us, talking to us about the history of labor here in Utah. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
You know, how long have you been active in the labor movement in Salt Lake City?
Well, I'm 78, and I joined my labor union when I was 20.
And what was that?
It was the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers.
And they're not around anymore.
They're not. They merged into the United Steelworkers.
But they were mostly a heavy mining kind?
They were the mining industry union, hard rock, not the cold, not the soft. And they had some trouble back in the 50s with a guy by the name of Joe McCarthy running the House Un-American Activities Committee. And they picked on two unions, especially for communist activity. One was the dock workers.
Longshore.
The other was the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers. And they had congressional hearings on them. And in the early 50s, it was really the question in everybody's mind out in the mining town of Magna and Garfield. And they finally, the CIO expelled Mine Mill for, they claimed, ties into the Communist Party.
Yeah, because anytime you stand up for workers and you want a decent wage and you want decent conditions, that's got to be communism, right, Pat?
Well, was that to shut up McCarthy? Was that really just a move to quiet his witch hunt?
No, I think labor was just part of it, and the dock workers was a bigger part of his attacks more than Mine Mill, but Mine Mill was in there, and they got into a lot of trouble with the members out there because they took the Fifth Amendment when they were asked any question, because once you take the Fifth Amendment, once you answer any question after you've taken the Fifth Amendment, and he had a way of making sure that the questions you ask was the kind that you was guilty right away.
Now you couldn't answer honestly.
You couldn't answer.
If you've read any of the testimony or looked at any of that, it was just a witch hunt from top to bottom, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, it was pretty awful. It's just interesting though that times haven't changed. Our congressional leaders now who want to do away with some of our dearest rights as people are going after the labor unions as well.
Well, from that part on, after the Mine Mill was expelled from the CIO, at that time the AFL and the CIO was separate.
Right.
And then they, really what they did is they gave the jurisdictional, the CIO did, jurisdictional rights to the mining industry, to the United Steelworkers. And the only reason there, I guess, the tie-in was that the steelworkers had the iron ore mines up in the Michigan and an iron ore range. So they had some mining history. But that started a real years of battle between the International Union of Mine, Mill, Smelter Workers and the steelworkers out here in Utah.
And that's a perfect condition for business when you've got two unions fighting each other. But that's a perfect condition for business to take advantage of and exploit.
And that was going on when I joined the non-male smelter workers. And then...
Was your mom worried that you were a communist?
I don't think my mother ever knew. But the funny part of it is I tell a story that I had a stepdad because my real dad was... He died in 1944. I wasn't very old. And he worked out at the Garfield smelter, which was... steelworkers, and I worked at the mills, concentrators, which is my mill. Same, we was processing the ores, and they were smelting them. And that's the only time he ever, raising a kid that was a little bit of a rebel, told me to leave the house. It was over the arguments between him and I about mine mill and the steelworkers.
Wow.
So it's the only time we ever argued. We used to, it was downtown. It was quite the arguments, but finally they got a new president in the steelworkers, a guy named I.W. Abel, and he approached mine mill the proper way, and it was worked out. Plus, mine mill was dying, I've got to admit that. Proper way to merge in, and in 1967, a deal was made that the International Union Mines, Mill, and Smelter Workers was merged into steelworkers. Now, that included mines out in Nevada and mines in Arizona, and when you mentioned the salt of the earth down in Chino, New Mexico. And they were all Kennecott properties, but they had different unions in. If you go back to the real history of the mine, and that was true down in New Mexico, too, the early organizing was done by crafts.
Right.
And even to this day in Bingham Canyon, there's machinist jurisdiction, there's a IBW jurisdiction, and there's multi-unions. The railroads have been done away with, but they had railroads. And then down to the concentrator, it was wall-to-wall one union, and so was its smelter. And then when the refinery was built, they became steelworkers. But at one time, it was kind of a mess of unions. And we had a...
And I'm sure they took advantage of pitting one unit against each other and worker against each other.
Especially when one of them would settle. And then the war would start. And it just so happened the steelworkers' contracts were up a month later than all the rest of the unions. So they had the second chomp at it. And sometimes it worked to our advantage, but most of the time it worked to the company's advantage. But after 1967 and the merger, then there was no mine mill. It was all steel workers, but with the craft unions still. And they're still there. And they negotiate now all as one.
Right.
They don't separate anymore. But back when I first became involved, it was a free-for-all, you might say.
When you first became involved in any knowledge you have of before that, what were the working conditions like? This doesn't sound like it was an easy job.
Well, no, a lot of people don't understand. It's dangerous as heck. And go out to a smelter and you find, I always tell people the worst thing I ever seen in all my time in the industry was to work into a copper smelter or a steel mill. Dangerous, dirty, bad air, especially in the coke ovens in the steel mills. But it was dirty. The mine, it's probably the cleanest place to work because you haven't hit when you crush ore, you make dust. And when you smell the ore, you make fumes. And when you refine it, you get bad fumes. And you got all that one in the making of copper. As a kid, things don't scare you very much. But as I think back, some of the things I did, I had one serious industrial accident, almost lost a foot. But I think back some of the things I used to do. We didn't have hard hats. Those respirators were just a pest to me. And I could breathe that dust and nothing was happening to me. I didn't know what it would do to me.
Nothing eventually, today, anyway.
Yeah. And you've heard about the silicosis, but you kind of, it's just misery have one of those darn things on. Later on, it became part of the requirement. And one of the things that really happened to make the mine safe is the passage of the Mine Safety Act. It didn't cover the smelter refinery because that had OSHA to come along. And
but OSHA didn't come along until 1970.
Yeah.
I mean, what were things like in the 60s and the 50s? And before you had, before unions were strong, even the numerous unions you had. I mean, I, as you're laying out these conditions, I can't imagine how horrible they were when workers didn't have any voice whatsoever. Oh,
well, you listen. I listened to the stories, how bad it was. And it was a lot worse than it was when I first joined. But there had been, 1955 is when I joined. There has been a lot of improvements made by that time. We made a lot after, but they had made a lot before that. But I can just imagine what it was like when they didn't have any of the unions.
Now, you had bad fumes. You had heat. I'm thinking incredible heat. Brutal work. What do you remember what you got paid when you first started?
Well, I thought it was terrific, but I found out, thinking back, it wasn't that. They made a lot of improvements. They just started having pension plans when I went to work there. Before that, they didn't have any pension plans.
You basically worked till you died.
Yeah, worked till you died. And the pensions went back for all the old-timers. But there was
the pensions went back?
Well, yeah. When we negotiated them, they didn't say people just starting at this date on got them.
Think about that. Go back to that time and think about today. What he just said is they negotiated a pension to cover the people who didn't have them.
Right. That's why Social Security started, too.
Now we're talking about taking away from people who have them.
Right. But that, I mean, I don't think this Congress would pass food stamps. I don't think this Congress would pass land-grant colleges. I don't think this Congress would give us, I don't think this Congress would pass Head Start. I mean, when you think about what was done, and you think about what we used to think of as, you know, people who were old-fashioned. We couldn't get any of this stuff out of the current Congress.
Now, the kids just don't realize how far things have come. I'll give you a little example. One of the first things that we had in when I got involved as an officer, we had all of the properties that Kennecott had, Arizona, New Mexico, Baltimore Refinery, Chino, New Mexico, and Utah, the highest paid workers, and they were all in a union, the highest paid workers were in Utah. They had what we called a Southwest differential. They paid people, mostly Mexican people, down in Arizona, New Mexico. They paid them a different rate of pay. We had a Donnybrook doing away with that, and we had a real tough time in Utah because we finally negotiated that everybody would get doing the same work, would get paid the same, whether they worked in Arizona, whether they worked in Utah. And that meant Utah had to take a little back off of the wages, and we had a hard time selling that to our members, but we did. And that showed what a union can do if it's all together. And
what a union should do.
What it should do. It just wasn't right to do that. When we started, we all got into steelworkers. By far the strongest union there was the steelworkers then. They wanted to negotiate the same way they did in basic steel, which was an industry-wide negotiations with all the copper companies. Right away we had a strike, and they took us to court, and they won. They said that we could not hold out one property to get something for another property. And
you
couldn't have all industries, because that was Phelps Dodge, Asarco, all of them, and this would have a master contract. And that's how they had it at steel at the time. And that's how they become the highest paid industrial workers in America, was industry-wide bargaining. Oh. But we lost that. But we did still had company-wide bargaining, which was still important. And there were four major big copper companies. We had to negotiate separately with them. What we wanted was to put them all in the same room because we was all doing the same work. But the big problem was Phelps Dodge. And I think we could have got Eisenhower, but Phelps Dodge wouldn't go along. Anyway, we lost in court, so we couldn't do it anymore. So then we had to do it just quietly, you know. We talked together.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we couldn't sit at the same table and demand the same things.
Well, here again, it goes back to Taft-Hartley and the changes there. You said something a minute ago, Wayne Holland, that caught my attention. You said kids don't understand how good they have it. And he says, because they don't realize how bad it was. I mean, because, you know, you stop and you think about it. Labor education has been completely done away with. The stories that your father told you and his father told him and how this stuff was handed down, I think the how bad it was has been kind of lost.
And I think it's a sad thing, but I think it's that way all across all jobs, not just that.
Because your generation, my grandparents' generation, fought, bled, died to make those horrible conditions more tolerable for themselves and then better for their kids and then better still for my generation. But now we're seeing them going the other way.
Yeah, there's all my years of organizing for the steelworkers, we tried to organize a company up on the Nevada or Utah Idaho border. And they're notorious in the mini mills, they call them. They melt down steel that's already been made. They don't make it from scratch.
Right.
And down there organizing, they told us, the crane men, they paid lousy wages, but they paid tremendous incentives, enough that their steel plants made what unionized steel plants made. And they made it by the sweat and blood of the members. And the cranemen had to take a can up in a crane with them.
I've heard that numerous times.
They wouldn't stop that.
And they, from what I understand, is what's going on in China right now.
And it was America. And they had cranemen tell me they did it. And
they brought the can up in case they had to use the restroom.
That was, and they also, if there was a guy had a car broke down on the way to work, and this was back in the 1980s when I was organizing there. If the car broke down, nobody would stop and help somebody, because if you missed 1 minute, you missed the incentive to pay for the whole day. And that's plant still operating, doing the same thing. They're one of the biggest steel plants in America. And
it's still not organized?
No, we've never been able to crack it. Steelworkers have tried very, very hard. Kind of like the automobile industry. They make automobiles here. Toyota does, but they're not organized, and they make sure they build the plants in the South where they know they can.
Where the laws are such where you can deny people, even if they want it. You're not going to get it.
There was a thing on the public television I was watching the other night about pensions. I remember the steelworkers telling me as a staff rep, don't negotiate 401k plans. You negotiate on those plans, and they'll take away from your pension power. And you look at it's just there now. They've taken so many pensions away.
What was the number? They've destroyed, was it 89,000 defined benefit plans decades?
It just breaks your heart to hear it go the way it is, because there's so many of them that out there working, and young people don't realize what a pension is until they get old enough.
Let me ask you, last question I've got for you, because I've really enjoyed you telling us about the history. I knew a guy I used to work with. He said right when he got back from Vietnam, he had gotten a little bit of money, just a couple of bucks that they gave him when he got out of the military, and he went back and he paid his father's bill to the company store, because the father had always worked on script. This is up in Northeast Pennsylvania. He said that was the first time in three generations that his family had not been indebted to the company store. And I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, that's within our lifetime.
It was in mine, because I was raised in Garfield. Garfield no longer exists. It was a company town, and the company finally sold it, moved all the houses out.
But moved all the houses out. What do you mean?
Moved all the houses out. Told them that either they had to buy them, or if they didn't have them removed by a certain date, they would just go in and demolish them.
And these were where people lived?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a sizable town. It was out by the smelter, and they had the store there. My time, that store was operated by the by a private contractor, but it was still a company store, and that was the only store there was in town. There was the grocery store and everything was there. You went down there and
company doctor, company doctor, company all that.
Had a company doctor. In fact, his AS&R was one of the more forward-thinking companies, and they had the smelter, owned it until 1960, when Kennecott bought it from them. And they had a dentist and a doctor out there, and that was their hospital medical plan. The first time I ever went to a dentist, my folks took me out to the plant where they had a dentist chair, and that was our dental plan, but they did have one. Kennecott.
Oh, you pay, I'm sure you paid for it too. Because,
I imagine they did.
What kind of wage did you get? Did they get wages? Because this guy explained it to me is he said, "Look, you know, they got a couple of pennies, you know, for you know whatever to save or whatever, but the vast majority of the wage that three generations of this friend of mine's family had to endure is they give you a little slip of paper, and on that slip of paper is what you had in the company account, and you went to the company store, the company doctor, the company dentist, or the company bar, and that was that."
The store, like I say, after the end of the Second World War, was run by a contractor, but before that it was run by the company, and that's the way it was.
Because you didn't have a choice to go to the next store or to the next doctor in another town. You had to use their stuff because you didn't make any money.
Did your dad work in that smelter?
He went to work in the smelter when he got out of the Navy. He was... from Minnesota.
Is that when you moved to Garfield?
Yes.
And when your dad was working there, the company still owned it?
Yes. They owned everything. That's to say, when they decided they were no longer... And they did this in Arizona and New Mexico.
And in Pennsylvania.
There was towns there just like was in Garfield. And they just decided they wasn't in the housing business anymore.
So what is Garfield now?
Just a piece of dirt. There's nothing there. No, they moved everything out.
So is it still owned by the company?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they own.
We can bring them back someday. See? They're thinking ahead.
There's nothing out there now that I remember, you know.
So when the contractor took over, you used U.S. currency?
Well, yeah, it was, you know, it wasn't that bad, but it was my folks was a little bit more independent, but I remember some of the guys I ran around with, everything was bought out of there, and they'd go down on payday and have to pay off what they charged, and that's whatever they had left over would be given to them.
And I'm sure there would be a ton
the check of interest. The check would go right to them.
I'm sure there was a ton of interest applied to that as well, especially if you didn't pay within the short term. You think the payday loans are bad? I'm sure that was worse.
But for a kid, it was a great place to grow up. I'm not trying to paint. I liked it because there was very, very little separation between, you know, the rich, the poor, everybody there. The supervisors, they lived somewhere else. They didn't live in the town.
They generally
in another company town.
Generally do. Wayne Holland, Sr., we greatly appreciate your time. Thank you so much for your story.
Okay, I hope I gave you what you wanted.
Well, it's fantastic. Thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break. The People's Tour for America on the road here in Salt Lake City, Utah. Right back after this break. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Pat LaMarche, and you're listening to an encore performance of the People's Tour for America. That's when Rick and I and the whole Rick Smith Show took off across the country to learn about labor history.
Rick, what are you doing here?
I just popped in to see how the Encore performances were going.
Go on vacation already. We'll be back after the new year with all new shows.
Weeknights, 9 to midnight, The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It's time to let these people learn the lesson.
You know, I want
to be.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Heading out of Utah, heading out of Salt Lake City through Wyoming. And, you know, I'm left, you know, as we left Salt Lake City, I'm left with this a feeling of hope, honestly. And some of the folks that we talked to today, the passion, the love of labor and of workers, I'm left with hope that, you know, even in the reddest of red states, that there is a vibrant, passionate labor movement there to fight for workers' rights.
Yeah, the young man who had never had any labor background, his dad was an accountant, and he's picked up the mantle and he's running with it. And he's had the experience. I mean, I wish every single human being could hear his story, because he's had an experience where he has been taken into the fold. You know, I don't know what an accountant thinks when his son said, "I want him to be a diesel mechanic." You know, I mean, that's not what most people think of what's going to happen when a new generation comes up, but there's certainly no more respectable work. You know, you're keeping all kinds of machinery moving, whether you're a diesel mechanic for a boat or a truck or whatever, or a aircraft. Pretty important jobs. And he found that by doing it through a union, he also had a family. You know, he had a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and that was pretty important, and he was ready to fight for it, and he was ready to do battle in the political realm for it. God.
And the other message I got out of that, and it's interesting you brought that up and you picked up on that. To me, it's, you know, it's the value of work. When I grew up, and I've said this before, my grandfather said, you know, if you drive a truck for a living, you'll be a failure, because he wanted me to go on to college, be the first in the family to graduate, which fortunately I did eventually complete my college degree and ended up getting a master's degree. But he wanted, you know, the next generation to have that white collar job, to be the accountant, not to have to do the hard physical work that he had to struggle with. But you know, for me, I look at this and I go, you know, we've got to make all of those jobs better.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we should be encouraging kids to get into building and to maintaining and to doing things that, well, where their passion follows them.
Smart stuff. I paid $90 one time to find the reset button on my garbage disposal. $90.
Wow.
I should have become a plumber. Well, obviously not, because I didn't even know where the reset button was on the garbage disposal, so that wouldn't be a very good plumber.
Although you would look good with the plumber's crack.
I'm pretty sure I can master that one without is that an apprenticeship program?
I don't know if there's a course on that, but you know, I'm sure you could pick up a couple of tips that way.
If there isn't, let me volunteer to teach one. And what happens really quick? When a guy goes home and his crack's been out all day, doesn't his wife say, "Honey, your ass is sunburned again. I think the pants might have been hanging a little low."
Oh, come on.
Somebody's got to tell him. That can't be a surprise.
Well, or maybe, you know, that's just a come on. It's where you're supposed to put the dollars.
Oh, my. I've done that all wrong all these years.
But, you know, I look at what's the conversation we had and, you know, the history that we picked up on. And, look, if you missed any portion of our program, then at ricksmithshow.com or peoplestourforamerica.com, where you can find out all the people we talked to today. And, you know, from the beginning of this tour, we've got it all.
We have Grant. We have Roger. We have Larry and Jeff and Steve. We have Gigi Mommy, known and loved by all from the Malloy and Horn chat rooms. We have Sandra, we have Kevin, and we have Cowgirl. And wow, what a wonderful gathering! Happy New Year's to you all. Shall we? Where do we want this to go? Don't everybody clam up at once.
No, I didn't get a volunteer to speak first.
So, I think I already took care of that.
Oh, I think everybody gets carried away. I want to give a shout out to somebody that's just listening. Is Maine Coyote.
Ow.
She doesn't show up on your. I mean, she's just in the chat room in the Skype.
Oh, okay.
And listening on the screen. She's busy with family stuff.
I understand.
Lobster pie.
Lobster pie?
Yeah.
Oh, is this the food porn portion of the program?
I was hoping Lottie would show up, but he told me he was busy, too, with food preps.
If I may ask, what on earth is lobster pie?
That may be a question that only Maine Coyote can answer.
We used to make it in Washington State, too.
Well, then, by all means, dish.
Well, it's like the same thing that, you know, when you make a mincemeat pie or a shrimp pie. Lobster's just the main ingredient.
Okay, that works for me. It sounds yummy enough.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah, here we go.
Too bad we weren't all close enough. We could just butcher a cow and we could have steak.
Hot diggity.
are you your cows?